Good morning, members. I see the gambling industry here is very much here in full force, as it were. And I hope you can see that we've only been able to secure this committee room, which is a little bit difficult for some people to see from. But nevertheless, we hope that we can work here constructively. I don't seldom say anything like these days, but I thought this may be of pertinence to us. I'm sure many of you read the paper, and I read this one about the 50% haircut, with the Greeks bearing the brunt of the Eurozone humor. And I thought that just one of the issues was rather amusing, which I'll read out. And that was an economic model correctly forecast the outlook for the European economy? Does it forecast a double-dip recession, a V-shaped recovery, or something else? The answer is, it forecasts, the model is the bathtub. A steep decline, then a period of stagnation, and then it goes down the drain. I think it's the sense of humor I was looking at rather than anything else on the Eurozone economy. But I'd like to say to the committee, thank you for being here. And it's a long day ahead of us, but it's an important issue on the table, so I hope many of us will be able to stay. We do have one challenge in front of us, and that was the budget review recommendation report, which includes the annual report. It is, I believe, a document that the draft is in front of you. And if you recall those who were present, there was only one issue, and that issue was look at it, see if that, you know, the format, not the substance, is there. We do have some challenges on some of the figures from the NCC, so I don't want to go down substantive routes. But suffice to say, none of this is to be seen as even draft three or any final position. I must make that clear. But it is there. You've had the BRRR for months developing. We've added to it, and the important thing for members is to take this home now. Study it so that, as I said on Wednesday at the time, there is a need for us to return on Tuesday to it. And the time you have secured, Mr. Hermans, at 10 o'clock in the morning until 1 o'clock on Tuesday. Many of us have other committees, I know, including myself and possibly the whip, but we really don't have a choice. The annual reports have to close off early next week. I did not wish to use a Monday. So I put that to you, and if there's any challenge, perhaps members can raise a hand when I put it to you again after tea. Is that all right? Thank you. The apologies here this morning, we have Ms. Kamalo and Ms. Labenia. Are there any other apologies for not being here and at other meetings? Honourable Mabasa?
Yeah, I'll be trotting between the two meetings. I'm double booked, economic development and trade and industry.
Thank you for briefing us on that. I know you are very much in demand there. And there is no other apology, all right? Looking at the agenda, it's a program today that we're going to run through on gambling. And it's a very full program. We would normally adopt an agenda, as members know, but as we're dealing with public hearings, I take it we're all well informed of what's going ahead, and I'm looking at members. I don't see any hands being raised, so we move ahead. Right. There are many, many of you here today, and let me just say right at the beginning, the people who will start with their inputs so that we can engage them is the South African Responsible Gambling Foundation. Well, I must say I thought everyone was responsible, but anyway. Professor Peter Collins, Executive Director, and of many things is the National Responsible Gambling Program. Right, and that is yourself, sir. Are you on your own then? Oh, right, thank you. Everyone got the present input, and you'll see from there, in terms of the time allocation, we were looking at, I think, about 20 minutes. So we're looking at, if you focus on 15 minutes, then I think you'll be all right.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will go as fast as I can. My presentation is really a short and up-to-date synopsis of the latest statistics, which I thought would be of concern to you, and also an up-to-date synopsis of the work of the National Responsible Gambling Program, which the SARGF delivers. Before I actually begin, though, I'd like to say something in a different capacity, which I said at my keynote address, the recent International Association of Gaming Regulators conference, namely that from my experience of studying gambling and public policy around the world, I can say pretty confidently that in South Africa we have legislation and regulation of gambling which is as good as in any other jurisdiction in the world in terms of both maximizing benefits and minimizing social costs, and it's a good deal better than the legislation and regulation in many jurisdictions. And one of the main reasons for this is that hitherto we have always had very good cooperation between regulators and politicians, the public sector on the one hand and the private sector on the other. In many jurisdictions, that relationship is antagonistic and destructive rather than collaborative and constructive. And I also think, though you might say, I would say this, wouldn't I, that we have been exceptionally successful in addressing what in the public mind is the most urgent issue regarding gambling, namely problem gambling, because we have developed this joint public-private sector partnership, which is the SARGF, and although it has input from both industry and regulators, its success depends on its being and being seen to be independent and authoritative of both government and industry, so that when we're rung up by journalists, on the whole, they tend to trust what we have to say to them. Let me begin by picking up on what the chairman said and dealing with the question of whether it isn't a contradiction in terms to talk about responsible gambling. Well, my definition of responsible gambling is responsible gambling is gambling which constitutes harmless entertainment like theme parks and movies, etc. Irresponsible gambling occurs when people, either through recklessness, ignorance, psychological disorder, or whatever, spend so much time and money gambling that they do significant harm to themselves and to others. I'm going to say quite a lot about, I'm going to give you quite a lot of statistics, so I want to say something about how these statistics have been gathered. They've been gathered by the NRGP over 10 years. There are other statistics which the National Gambling Board has gathered, but I should be focusing mainly on the ones that we have gathered since 2001. We have, however, there's an important change in the methodology that we have used. particularly in relation to the 2011 study, which was an omnibus study of the whole country, including the 8 million or so people who live in tribal trust lands and rural areas, and where there's virtually no gambling at all. Previously, our samples had concentrated only on adults living in areas with reasonably good, easy access to the forms of gambling, notably lotteries and casinos and LBMs, which were legalized in 2005. So you will notice that difference. Then there's one other point I'd make about the statistics, and that is that because people, particularly I know parliamentarians, are always especially worried about the poor and the impact of gambling on the poor, we have undertaken a specialist poverty study in two areas in KwaZulu-Natal, one a rural designated exceptionally poor area and the other an urban area of the same sort. Now, here are some of the most striking trends in relation to participation in gambling. You may be surprised about how much non-gambling has increased. In 2001, about 26% of the adult population didn't gamble at all, and just under half of those who did gamble only played the lottery, didn't gamble on anything else. By 2008, the number of non-gamblers, possibly because the lottery was suspended, possibly because of recession, had grown, the number of non-gamblers had grown to 48%, but still, half of those who do gamble only play the lottery. And in our 2011 survey, where you'd expect bigger numbers of non-gamblers because it includes all those rural areas I was talking about, actually 68% of the sample never gamble. So when you exclude also the half of the population which is underage for gambling, the number of people who gamble and gamble regularly in South Africa is not actually now very huge, and it's quite a small proportion of the population. I don't attribute that to anything much other than the general recession and the general decline in expenditure on various forms of entertainment, eating out, going to movies, and also a decline, which you find in other jurisdictions as well, in lottery sales, which, as we've seen, is the most popular form of gambling. These were the NGB figures in 2009. Note that, according to their figures, only 6.3% of the population participated in casino gambling, whereas something close to 6% played in illegal forms of gambling, farfi dice and cards. So this is a theme I shall be returning to. Our figures for 2008 were only slightly different, so the NGB figures tend to confirm our figures. Now, what do poor people do in relation to gambling? Well, our poverty study showed that very poor rural people barely gamble at all. Fairly poor people gamble somewhat more than affluent people. And that, of course, is a trend which you find worldwide. Gambling tends to be an activity most popular with socioeconomic groups C and D, not E's, because they're too poor, rather than A's and B's. Poor people, and this is an important point for policy and Parliament to be aware of, poor people are particularly vulnerable if they are young, unemployed men playing informal games at illegal venues such as shebeens. Poor people in metropolitan areas tend to engage in the cheaper and geographically more accessible forms of gambling, whether legal, such as lottery products, or illegal, such as ifafi dice, etc. Now, there's a table of what people earning less than $2,000 a month, and reported they don't, earns less than 2,000 a month in 2008 played on. And you will see that most of the, by far the largest number is the lottery, followed by scratch cards, followed by Fafi, slot machines are 3.9 and roulette is 0.5. So that gives you an idea of what poor people are doing in relation to gambling. As for general problem gambling numbers, we've done 5 surveys since 2001, and on the whole, from survey to survey, problem gambling numbers have either held steady or declined. They were originally at somewhat above the norms in developed countries, and in 2011, they were at their lowest ever, that is, at about 1%. In 2008, using the Canadian Problem Gambling Index, which is reckoned to be the best screen in the world now, we had 90 respondents who scored more than 8, thus being accounted high risk for problem gambling, which was about 3% of the 3,000 sampled by Markinor in metropolitan areas. In the 2011 sample, also carried out by Markinor, but bearing in mind that this was a nationwide and not just a metropolitan sample, the number of problem gamblers was 0.7. The similar number in Britain in the most recent survey is 0.6. However, allowing for the non-gamblers in rural areas, and if we want to compare the 2008 and the 2011 sample, we get 22 out of about a population of 2,000, which gives us a decline from 3% to 1%. And this number is very close to the latest figures for developed countries in Europe and the rest of the English-speaking world, and considerably lower than countries, lower than Asian countries. By type of activity, we did this in 2008, dividing people into those who only played the lottery, those who only engage in legal forms of gambling, and those who engage in illegal forms of gambling, whether or not they also engage in legal forms of gambling, notably the lottery. And you will see that lottery-only players constituted 22% of problem gamblers. Problem gamblers who played at legal regulated venues, 13%. They constituted 13% of problem gamblers. And of those who engaged in illegal activities, whether or not they also engaged in legal forms, they constituted two-thirds, 65% of the problem gamblers. So we're increasingly getting the picture that that is where the problem is. It's illegal gambling played typically in townships in and around shebeens. And the games are games like echina, ifafi, cards, and dice. And the reason for that is no doubt the Casino Association would like me to tell you, because they behave so immaculately in their delivery of their services, and no doubt there's an element of truth in that. But the main reason is that people who play illegal forms of gambling can afford to do that, whereas they can't afford to play at casinos, which is expensive to get into, expensive to travel to, and expensive to play at. So it's mostly economics that account for this. Now, a last point which is going to become very important for my conclusion. We have also done studies on what other problems people who have gambling problems also have. And the answer is that in South Africa, our figures show that at least 30% of people with a gambling problem have either got another addiction or a depressive disorder or an anxiety disorder. And in the United States, the estimates are as high as 5% for comorbidity. And this has meant that we've had to change our whole treatment approach so that we now diagnose people comprehensively under the supervision of the UCT Psychiatric Department, and we customize our interventions, mainly using CBT, but occasionally using appropriate treatments for bipolar disorder on the one hand, and for brief interventions like motivational interviewing on the other. Let me just tell you a bit about the South African Responsible Gambling Program. It's a set of activities designed to minimize the harm caused by excessive gambling, mainly by promoting public awareness of the way commercial gambling works, its potential dangers and how to avoid them, by publicizing the availability of free confidential expert help for problem gamblers and those close to them, and understanding through research the extent, nature, causes and consequences of excessive gambling so as to inform good policy and regulation and better treatment and prevention. We are supervised by a board of directors who comprise equal numbers of industry professionals and regulators who, however, serve in their personal capacities, not as representatives, and on the basis of their expert knowledge. We are funded mainly by voluntary contributions from the industry, receiving just over $15 million a year in 2011 and 2012, and additional $3.5 million for special projects by the Gauteng Gambling Board. We regularly report quarterly and annually to national and provincial governments and their agencies, as well as to members of this committee. What do? Well, we run a free 24/7 counselling service which refers people for diagnosis and treatment around the country in a language of their choice for family counselling, money management counselling, and occasionally we subsidise inpatient treatment. We run extensive public service advertising in local papers and on local radio stations, as well as doing some public transport advertising and TV advertising, alerting people to the dangers of gambling and how to avoid them. We have an extensive national schools program which we're currently rolling out, which is not only about gambling, it's called Taking Risks Wisely. It educates young people about the dangers of sex, debt, drugs, as well as gambling. It's integrated with the life skills curriculum. It provides teachers with lesson plans, exercises, and audiovisual material by text and on the web. And it facilitates numeracy skills, critical thinking skills, and communication skills through studying probability and, incidentally, through holding classroom debates on subjects like, is gambling immoral? Should gambling be banned? We do research, as you will have seen, monitoring gambling participation and problem gambling in South Africa. We do special studies into gambling amongst the poor, and we ensure that the best and most up-to-date international research is adapted to the special needs of South African regulators, treatment professionals, and public awareness professionals. Does the program work? Well, the public awareness works quite well by comparison with similar activities which have public awareness programs. Note on that slide that in a sample of people interviewed face-to-face outside a shopping mall, 40% knew that free confidential help was available, and of people who'd come out of a casino, 72% knew. And the other figures are encouraging as well, though never grounds for complacency. As far as treatment is concerned, the good news is that about 80% of those who seek treatment, when followed up after 6 months, are free of problem gambling. The bad news is that we, in common with every other service of the same sort in South Africa and indeed throughout the world, find that most of the people who would benefit from treatment never seek it. And we don't know why that is. It doesn't mean they don't get better, but we would like many more people to seek treatment than in practice do. And quite a lot of those who seek treatment don't complete the course, though that doesn't necessarily mean that they haven't got better. And we're working on these problems because we recognize their importance. I want to identify some areas of concern which I would draw to your attention. Half the population of South Africa is under the legal age for gambling, but many of them already gamble informally and online.
and this problem will increase as ease of access to gambling via cell phones increases and tablets and all the modern technology. Secondly, unless internet gambling can only be advertised by companies with land-based operations, which are licensed and therefore taxed and regulated in this country, online gambling at inadequately regulated offshore sites will continue to grow rapidly among South Africans, both exacerbating problem gambling and losing tax revenues. The reason for that is that the law enforcement costs would be so prohibitive of raiding people's rooms at 3 o'clock in the morning and confiscating their computers to see whether they've been playing poker at online. It would be politically and economically impossible. You can do that sort of thing with child pornography and the financing of terrorism. I don't believe any jurisdiction has succeeded in doing it for online gambling. The problems of land-based illegal gambling appear to be growing in South Africa and to be exacerbating existing social problems, especially amongst young men who gamble and drink at shebeens. And then finally, a statistic about the lottery, which is still probably the safest form of gambling because you don't do much of it, but it is the one area which is seriously out of line with international norms. In the UK, the percentage of problem gambling who only play the lottery was 0.1% of adults in 1999. In South Africa, it was 1.7 in 2001, 3.6 in 2003, and in 2008, the number was 2.9. And it is now a bigger source of problem gambling in the 2011 study than is other forms of legal gambling. Let me leave you with a demonstration of my ability to control your minds, which will have a lesson for you as you proceed in your deliberations. I want you to focus now on one of those cards you see on the board. I want you to think very hard about it so that as I look round, I can read your minds. Right, I've done that. Now your card has disappeared. Am I right? How did I do that? Answer, look again. None of the cards in the first list are the same as the cards in the second list. But you were concentrating only on your card. So what's the lesson? Beware the illusions of appearances and preconceptions, including statistical illusions. Make sure you concentrate on the important issues and the whole picture and not just a part of it. In South Africa, note also that we have a very comprehensive and fantastically cost-effective infrastructure offering free telephone counselling round the clock, free confidential expert therapy, extensive public service advertising, and world-class research. However, these services are at present only available for the comparatively small issue of problem gambling. Something similar should be in place for the problems of alcohol and drug abuse, because these problems are much larger, both in terms of the number of people they affect and the severity of the damage they do. It would be naughty of me to say that in South Africa we actually have almost one regulator for every problem gambling. And I'm sure that isn't quite true, but it is true that compared with drink and drugs, problem gambling is a small problem. That doesn't mean it's an unimportant problem, but it is being fairly comprehensively addressed, and I would very much like to see that being done for drink, drugs, and other social problems with which problem gambling is often associated. If you would like further details, you can get all our information on the website, or you can contact me directly. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much yourself, Mr. Collins. Thank you. I must say that you've become quite a wizard with cards. Now, members, I just want to caution you, we don't have long for engagement on each one. I don't want anyone taking more than a minute with their range of questions, and then I'll allow for the four questions, you know, four people. Honourable Khadebe, Honourable Smala, Honourable Harris. Is that it so far? Right, there is one outstanding opportunity. Honourable Khadebe.
Thank you, Chairperson. First of all, I think the presentation is welcome, but what I'd like to ask, the question I want to ask, I think there are three. The first one, this Lento responsibly comes in South Africa. How many workers does it have, its component? What is its footprint throughout the provinces? Because I can see it's supported by Housing and Gambling Board. What about other provinces? What is its footprint to report? In the other provinces. Number two, Chair, when coming to the issue of gambling, I think the one which is going to be problematic is the issue of online gambling. As the presenter has said, what can be done to stop that? Because I remember that when you go to a country like China, when they wanted to stop internet, they stopped it through the gadget of the intelligence services. What can be done to control that in South Africa? And then the last one, but not the least, is the issue of decisively dealing with this issue of gambling. Well, what is this attitude when they say the legislators say that we have to ban then to gambling advertising? Let's say we control it, but let's ban the advertising thereof. Because it's true, when you see that the issue of Lotto is escalating, because Lotto is brought straight into the living room of the people in the form of the TV. Taking up last night, it was advertised that, what's that one? The ball, the one which uses the ball. Yeah, exactly. They said that it's 34 million, right, in the living rooms of the people. So really, it means that if it can go into the living rooms of the people, it means that it can reach almost more than half of the population of the country. So what is the attitude of gambling in South Africa when saying that we should ban such advertisement? Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much. Honourable Khadebe, Honourable Smala.
Chair, thank you. I'm going to try to focus on the how part and how the stats can maybe assist us into concluding where we want to go as a committee. Your funding model. Is it efficient as it is now, because the money that you do come, because if I look at your strategy, look at obviously linking into your marketing of your product, or that there are some certain concerns that you don't reach enough people in more ways than one. Is that to do with your funding model? I do note that there are some of the institutions that don't contribute to your assistance of what you are trying to achieve. And I think the committee will address that at a later stage, but I just would like to get an answer on that and on that specific perspective. Your stats, your research, have you tried to look into what online your illegal gambling stats? Did it actually focus also a little bit on online gambling, yes or no? And to just to broaden my picture on where I want to go later on, but I'm just going to focus on that too.
Thank you very much. Honourable Harris?
So I'm mindful of the fact that from today's agenda, this looks like the only regulatory body we have reporting to us. Or monitoring body. So we perhaps need to finish this session prepared for many more presenters who have perhaps different motivations. So I want to make sure that we do get as much information as we need to prepare us. You didn't cover any racing issues, yet we have many racing bodies coming later in the day. If you've done any work in that area, can you fill us in on it? I'm also, there's been a few questions about the public components of your public-private structure. It's quite clear which private actors are involved, but how can you just clear up exactly how the state is involved in your work beyond the fact that half of your directors are from regulators. And then that raises the question of the regulatory structures we have in place. You suggested that there was one regulator for every problem, but are you suggesting then that we need to consolidate? Are we over-regulating, or are the regulatory structures perhaps overlapping and uncoordinated? Then the issue, I'm trying to understand how problem gambling manifests itself in the lotto. You said 22% of problem gamblers only use the lotto. I mean, what does that look like? Is that somebody who just spends too high a proportion of their money on it? It spends all day waiting to see the results? To me, it seems like a relatively benign form of gambling because it's disconnected. It's not in your face, so I'd like to understand that better. And then online gambling, you make one suggestion. This is my last one, Chair. You make one suggestion that we should restrict internet gambling advertising to companies with land-based operations. That's all very well. Do you have any other recommendations in that space? And then lastly, I think
Right. I only have one short question. Can you give me the name of a country, Mr. Collins, where they have put measures in place to ban online or internet gambling, and if it's working? And if it is working?
Thank you. Well, can I take the last question first because it makes it easy to answer. The most obvious example is the USA, where they have sought to ban internet gambling by making it the same effect for bankers to process internet gambling transactions as it is for internet suppliers to supply gambling, and that includes supplying through foreign companies supplying American citizens with gambling services. The general view is that the legislation was pretty ill thought out.
Is your mic on?
No.
Is my mic on?
Sorry.
Yes, well, fortunately we can let that one ride a little, but go on.
Is it on now? Right. The US have tried to ban internet gambling. They have done it by controlling banking, and the general view is that it has certainly not been 100% successful, and there are legislative moves afoot to legalize gambling for that reason, partly because people don't see any harm in people playing poker online and so forth. Taking some online questions together, I did make the suggestion that it's very difficult to ban online gambling through law enforcement, and much easier to eliminate it through carrots rather than sticks. And if you actually had gambling supplied to South Africans by companies which were based in South Africa, regulated in South Africa, paid taxes in South Africa, and they were the only ones allowed to advertise. And what's more, you might have an ombudsperson so that people with complaints, about unfair treatment or would have someone they could actually appeal to. Then I think market forces would mean that most South Africans who wanted to gamble online would gamble with South African companies under South African law, paying South African taxes. Obviously, if you were to do that, you couldn't use advertising as a carrot. It wouldn't make sense to ban all gambling advertising. I'm not myself particularly in favor of banning advertising. It doesn't seem to me there's all that much difference between banning advertising and, say, banning X-rated films or whatever they are. I'm not sure how much difference it would make to the industry
if all advertising was banned, simply because most advertising, as we know, is competitive advertising. You have to advertise your products because your competitors are advertising theirs. I doubt it would make much difference to problem gambling rates, because problem gambling, you know, problem gamblers are going to gamble anyway, one way or the other. And it's very, very important in this connection when thinking about internet and thinking about land-based gambling as well, to remember that we did not introduce legal gambling in this country because we thought, wouldn't it be wonderful if lots of South Africans engaged in lots of gambling? We introduced legal gambling because we have a massive, unregulated, illegal industry, such that there were unregulated, non-tax-paying slot machines in small venues in every dorp in the country, and they were associated with other sleazy things like drug dealing and prostitution. And now we've got a well-regulated industry, and most of that illegal industry has been got rid of. And so the way to get rid of businesses you don't like is not to prohibit them, but to legalize them, regulate them, and tax them. That's my general view. We were asked about the funding model for our program. The first thing to say about that is that we have no preconceived ideas of what the number should be. What we did was we drew up a list of activities that we thought needed to be undertaken in order to do as much as is reasonably possible to minimize the harm caused by excessive gambling in South Africa. We then costed those activities, and we then worked out what that total cost would be as a percentage of the South African industry's gross gambling revenues, and the number came to 0.1%, and 0.1% is what they have paid ever since, with the exception of the lottery, which has never contributed. It's not the lottery company's fault. It's because the regulators, possibly acting under the influence of government, have wanted to say lottery is not a form of gambling. We like lottery because it brings in lots of money for good causes. If we said lottery is a form of gambling, then we might well find that lots of people who currently play the lottery would stop, and we'd stop getting the money for good causes. So I don't entirely blame the lottery people, but it has been a serious problem that the lottery do not contribute to the SARGF. Our funding model has been adequate to our purposes. We have a rule that we never turn away anyone who seeks treatment, and everybody understands that if that meant we exceeded our budget, they would have to find more money. Things like research and public awareness, you can always do more of, and you can always do less of. But actually, as I showed you, the evidence is that public awareness, particularly amongst gamblers, of our services and of our name, is pretty high. In fact, it's outstandingly high by comparison with similar services for other things. So we are not pleading poverty at the moment. Of course, like all organizations, you can always spend more money on more things, and we do think the lottery should come in.
Can I just advise you that
yes,
you need to be more concise?
Sorry, I will try.
Because we've only got a couple of more minutes.
Right, okay. Racing issues, we do have data on racing issues. It's a small part of the industry. It's certainly not especially problematic. We lump it to it causes no more and no less problems than casinos, for example. All the data about all our research findings, including details about racing, are readily available on our website, which you've got up there. And you're welcome to write to me if you'd like more specific details. What have I not answered?
The footprint.
The number of people employed.
Yeah, part-time and full-time.
Yes, and you know, we're about not just half
right.
And so on.
Right. One of the things that makes us very cost-effective is that we have no full-time employees except for our telephone counsellors. Everybody else is employed part-time for what they do. We have a network of 75 treatment professionals, most of whom are clinical psychologists, for whom we provide annual training. They speak every conceivable language in the country, and they are spread out throughout all nine provinces, on a proportional basis, on a needs-driven basis. We have six full-time telephone counselors, and we have just changed our research model, and we are now advertising throughout the country to get proposals for research from all over the place. Previously, we've had a contract with UCT to deliver three projects, but now we're going national, and we are incidentally including a requirement that research projects actually involve capacity training in research for previously disadvantaged individuals.
Thank you so much. And there are six full-timers. One of them is yourself, of course.
No, I'm part-time.
Right. What is their profile, as it were, demographically speaking?
The profiles are, I am white.
You're part-time.
Yes, well, I'm the executive director, and I report to the Board of Trustees. The Board of Trustees subcontracts the public awareness to a company called Corporate Image, which has a BBBE rating of, I can't remember what it is. It's at least five. The treatment director is a white woman clinical psychologist, Dr. Pretorius, but most of the treatment professionals are not white.
Can I ask you to send us this in writing?
Yes.
Thank you very much. Look, Mr. Collins, you've shared this with us. Thank you very much. I hope you will stay for as long as you can as well, but perhaps just now you'll make way for somebody else coming up to the front. Right. We now have the Gold Circle Limited in front of us. And I see here we've got Mr. Grammy Hawkins. Mr. Grammy Hawkins.
Over here, Madam Chair.
Where's here? Oh, yes, I think you'll have to come to the front, you see. That's the point I was making. Mr. Dean Fonseca. I wonder if everyone has got this so that they're able to assist themselves in movement. And Mr. Michael Narakis, there are three of you. But if at least one of you can come up here, the main person, please. And the other people to get ready would be the Racing South Africa, Mr. Peter Gibson, CEO, Racing South Africa. There's only one person here. So here we are. You're on hand right now, are we, Mr. Grammy Hawkins? So we've already mentioned Racing South Africa. And then I imagine the whole bingo group may not be able to come up to the front. But it's Advocate Stephen Budlander, Mr. John Ziff, Ms. Esty Brand, Mr. Philip Abrahams, Mr. Lawrence Smith, Mr. Alan Scott, and Mr. Christy Toy. Over to yourself then, Mr. Grammy Hawkins, the Gold Circle, and you're very welcome. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Just so that you know your timing, now 10:05. We're going to be taking you, let's work on the 10 to 15 minutes because the questions seem to be more.
Well, I'll also try and be as brief as I can. Firstly, may I begin by extending a vote of thanks to the committee for affording us the opportunity to present this morning. As you've already mentioned, my name is Graham Hawkins. I'm Gold Circle's Chief Operating Officer, and my colleagues on the other side are the Acting Chief Executive Officer, Michelle Narek, and Dean Fonseca from our firm of attorneys. Can I just check, Madam Chair, that members of the committee have in front of them a copy of our submission this morning? Gold Circle's submissions thus far, then, Gold Circle was invited to comment upon a paper prepared by the Gambling Review Commission entitled Review of the South African Gambling Legislation and its Regulation, which was published in July 2011. Gold Circle then filed with the chairperson of the Portfolio Committee a detailed 22-page submission document, which was dated the 6th of September, and which should also be before the committee. And now you have a summary of this oral submission. By way of background and introduction, a brief explanation of Gold Circle's structure, management, and business follows on the next three pages. First of all, our structure. Gold Circle is a private company owned in equal shares by the following turf clubs: Durban Turf Club, Pietermaritzburg Turf Club, Clarewood Turf Club, and the Western Province Racing Club. Gold Circle is prohibited by its Articles of Association from distributing profits. Any profits are ploughed back into thoroughbred horse racing. Gold Circle will restructure in the near future, but will not deviate from its non-proprietary status and its philosophy to be a stakeholder company. We ask you to bear in mind that Gold Circle is a purpose-driven company, and our purpose is the promotion and the maintenance of the sport of horse racing. Moving on to management structures, Gold Circle's board currently comprises 8 non-paid, non-executive electees of the clubs, 2 executive directors co-opted by the electees, and 1 invited external director also co-opted by the electees. Because of our purpose, all board members are obliged to be registered participants in the sport of horse racing. Gold Circle's business is steered and directed by the non-paid, non-executive electees who provide their time and their expertise free for the benefit of the sports. A brief description of Gold Circle's business. As mentioned previously, Gold Circle's raison d'etre is the promotion, the execution, and the maintenance of the sport of thoroughbred horse racing. Gold Circle operates thoroughbred horse racing in KwaZulu-Natal and the Western Cape, and totalizator betting in these two provinces. Gold Circle itself employs 2,500 people, and the income streams stem primarily from betting as to 80% and other business activities as to 20%. The state of the sport of horse racing, Gold Circle stakeholders' precarious financial position. Gold Circle has not been able to increase prize money to owners and returns to stakeholders since 2008. In fact, on the contrary, prize money was decreased in 2010. Participation to the sport is stimulated by the level of prize money. Gold Circle's Western Cape operation in particular is not sustainable and will collapse unless fundamental reorganization of its business is facilitated, which the Gold Circle board hopes to execute just as soon as is possible. The sport is administered by Gold Circle in KwaZulu-Natal and the Western Cape, and by Pumalela Gaming Limited in other provinces, and the sport of horse racing is in serious decline. The sport is ultimately funded by racehorse owners as to 25%, and punters as to 75%. Owners in South Africa right now can expect to be paid an average of 4,800 rand in prize money for every 10,000 rand spent on owning and training. Owners, it can be immediately seen, show a significant loss of millions and millions and millions of rand, hundreds of millions of rands each year. There is accordingly a disincentive to own horses. Owners and breeders have dropped significantly in number since 2001, breeders by as much as 51%. With costs rising and prize money stagnating, the gap between what owners invest every year and the prize money paid by racing operators is widening alarmingly. Clearly, this funding model is not sustainable. It should be borne in mind that owners of thoroughbred racehorses are, in fact, major employers of people throughout the sport of horse racing. They directly employ the trainers, who in turn employ thousands of grooms. They employ the jockeys. And very importantly, their investment in thoroughbred racehorses determines the sustainability of breeders and stud farms, and therefore the level of employment in this sector, particularly in rural areas. Owners are the demand chain, breeders are the supply chain. Disincentivizing owners leads to disincentivizing breeders, all of which directly affects employment and, of course, the viability of the sport as a whole. By comparison, in Singapore, India, or Hong Kong, owners profit from their investment in thoroughbred racehorses. Now, due to these pressures and the need to rationalize, a number of racecourses in South Africa have already closed down, and a few more have been earmarked for also being closed. It goes without saying that the sport does require certain critical infrastructure, and the onus for this funding rests solely with the operators, and we do not believe this to be fair. Bookmakers, for example, who leverage off the sport of horse racing, do not fund this infrastructure. It's listed there. I don't intend going through each and every one, but in this regard, I would like to make special mention of the sports regulator, the National Horse Racing Authority, who will, in due course, also be presenting a paper to the committee. Their annual budget is 46 million rand alone. Bookmakers benefit directly from the critical regulation of the sport, but make absolutely no contribution to this budget. We go on to cover the consequences of the declining sport. Quite obviously, from an employment perspective, a decline in the sport will result in a permanent loss of jobs and skills. Similarly, a decline in the sport would see a lost or diminished opportunity for transformation, as well as a loss of the value of the transformation capital that has already been transferred or generated. The sport of horse racing has been and continues to be a significant and efficient taxpayer, and a declining sport will see a reduction of a substantial tax base, and a declining sport will see a reduction in the gross domestic product. And so on to the gambling review itself. We have some yays and some nays, some thumbs ups and some thumbs downs. We agree a complete review of the horse racing industry is necessary. We agree that market forces should regulate the number of racetracks. We agree with the Commission's recommendation to consider statutory recognition and the introduction of a fairer funding mechanism for the National Horse Racing Authority, as I mentioned just a few seconds ago. We agree that the operators should have the ability to integrate horse racing tracks with gaming, and we accept the challenge to modernize, to launch new products, to rebrand racing, but we must have greater freedom to do so in line with the freedom our competitors enjoy in this all-important area. Playing fields must be fair to all. Some of the nays to come out of the Gambling Review's report: we strongly disagree that consideration should be given to the separation of racing and totalizator operators. Madam Chair, if you'd allow me to refer to a recent conference of leaders, worldwide leaders in racing, which took place in London just earlier this month. As you all may know, the Hong Kong Jockey Club is probably one of the most successful racing jurisdictions in the world, and the chief executive officer of the Hong Kong Jockey Club, Winfred Engelbert Bridges, said this at the conference. He said that most racing jurisdictions still had to address the problem that they were not vertically integrated. Notable exceptions to this are the successful nations such as Japan, Hong Kong, and Singapore. He didn't specifically mention South Africa, but we're included in that group. Elsewhere, elements such as race production, race planning, prize money, etc., are all basically operated under different ownerships. Without this integration, the task of agreeing a growth strategy becomes difficult, as the interests of various stakeholders are not necessarily aligned. We do not necessarily agree with national regulation for telephone and internet betting. We oppose the review of ratings totalizators' participation in sports pools, and we do not believe it necessary or appropriate to control cell phone usage for betting purposes. Staying with the Gaming Review's report, we note a few fundamental errors. Two companies uniquely hold licenses to run tote betting. They note that Pumalela runs the tote for both companies. That is incorrect. Gold Circle runs its own tote, and Pumalela runs its own tote. 3% collected from bookmakers. And out of this, they comment that tax is not shared with other sports bodies. Those are winning bets and other sports betting, which are in fact zero rated. There is no tax to share. They suggest that operators derive revenue from stakes paid. That is completely incorrect. Stakes are an expense to both operators. And very importantly, almost casually, the report kind of makes the assertion that the sport will survive.
Just repeat that on the stakes.
The commission report suggested that operators derive revenue from stakes paid. We're not quite sure what they meant by that, but clearly stakes paid, which is prize money paid to stakeholders within the industry, is a cost to Gold Circle and, of course, to Pumalera as well. And then, as I said, they almost sort of casually in their report suggest that the sport will survive the economic downturn. Well, we're not so sure of that. Some of their omissions: their failure to recognize unfair practices within the industry, failure to recognize the sporting aspect of the industry, and I'm going to come back to that in a moment, failure to recognize the international successful horse racing jurisdictions in their models. And just a moment ago, I did refer to that when I alluded to Hong Kong, Japan, Singapore, Malaysia, and the like. We move on to a section in our oral submission today, which of course supports our written submission of the 6th of September. We're there to offer some solutions. And paramount for us is recognition of thoroughbred horse racing as a sport. We believe this to be most important and paramount to our future sustainability. Horse racing is not only a national sport in South Africa, where it enjoys a rich history and stages iconic sporting social events such as the Vodacom Durban July and the J&B Met. But we are now very much a highly respected player on the vast global stage that is international horse racing. We have, as a sport, in recent years achieved significant global success with our horses, with our jockeys, in Hong Kong. 18 of the last 20 years, the champion jockey in that jurisdiction has been a South African. Our trainers internationally, and even our regulating and other officials, are sought after on the international stage. Very importantly, this has led to ever-increasing economic benefits for the country, and more people from abroad come to purchase our horses than ever before, and, apart from the horses, they indeed purchase the rights to broadcast and bet on our racing. I've been in the sport of horse racing for a very long time, but I have never been so proud of our sport as when our national anthem, Inkosi Sikelela, rang out in front of 80,000 people at Sha Tin Racecourse in Hong Kong following trainer Mike de Kock's victory recently in a major race there with a South African bred horse, trained by a South African, ridden by a South African jockey, and accompanied by the horse's own black South African and very proud groom, who could never before have dreamt of finding himself on such an international stage. This was a great sporting moment for South Africa, but unfortunately not recognized as such by so many, and we believe this must change. Horse racing's treatment
as a gambling-related industry, as opposed to a sport on which gambling takes place, has resulted in measures designed to limit rather than expand its growth, onerous operating conditions which increase operating costs and limit its ability to evolve its funding model, the erosion of its traditional funding sources as a result of the liberalization of gambling activities. We believe the funding model requires overhaul. In South Africa, mainstream sports are typically funded by a combination of government grant funding, contribution to admin costs, tax relief, etc., participant contribution, and very importantly for some of those other sports, commercial revenue sources such as sponsorships, television rights, merchandising, etc. Horse racing is not funded in this way. It is funded by the operations as set forth earlier. It has a unique funding model which was, but is no longer relevant or sustainable.
Just a little reminder, you're running in downtime, as it were.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will try and accelerate. I used to be a commentator, and I might be able to get that right.
Yeah, right.
What is needed, we believe, is participant funding by all participants, government assistance, commercial revenue streams improved, revenue diversification, and for the betting on the sport of horse racing to be more appropriately regulated. We believe a new regulatory environment is required where all those who trade of the sport are required to contribute to its operations in an equitable manner. Because the regulatory environment at the moment facilitates totalized data type betting through bookmakers, thereby robbing the sport of income which it would otherwise have received through totalized data betting. A sustainable funding model should place as little reliance on the fiscus as possible. Gold Circle accepts that proposition. However, in the short term, the sport faces a crisis and requires government assistance as set out on page 18 of today's document. A sustainable sport requires more than just participant funding and government assistance. The sale and licensing of intellectual property and broadcasting rights is a major source of revenue for successful sporting codes such as soccer, rugby and cricket. But today, under certain operators' license conditions, horse racing operators are prohibited from charging commercial rates for the sale and licensing of intellectual property. Quite clearly, we believe there is an urgent need to lift these restrictions. Existing infrastructure and betting expertise within the sport can effectively and efficiently be utilized in the operation of casino licenses and horse racing tracks, reducing the sport's reliance on sports betting funding as a prime source of funding. Horse racing constitutes 1/20th of all sports contributions to the economy, and yet it employs as much as 1/3 of all of those employed in sports. The reliance by the sport on betting is an efficient and desirable methodology of funding, but the current regulatory environment inhibits rather than enhances the sports funding model by providing an environment in which the gambling industry is diversified to include more efficient and convenient gambling activities unrelated to sports and providing the gambling industry, particularly the bookmakers, with opportunities to avoid funding of underlying sports on which betting revenues are generated. I'm getting towards the winning post, Madam Chair. Interim measures to regulate the sports betting, or the betting on racing more appropriately. We'd like to suggest that pending a full review of the sport of horse racing, as we have suggested we support, the granting of horse racing totalizers licenses must be limited to horse racing operators. Just recently, a third party was awarded a totalizer license by the Mpumalanga Racing and Gaming Board. The cost of totalizer operations must be reduced by simplified regulatory requirements and taxations. A prohibition must be imposed on the appropriation by bookmakers of the totalizer results for the purpose of offering the open bet. Fair and expeditious procedures should be introduced for the opening and regulation of totalizer agencies so as to reduce their costs and administration to be not inconsistent with the less onerous provisions applicable to bookmakers. The streamlining of approvals for new bet types or rule changes for totalizer betting so that the process is not inconsistent with, again, the less onerous provisions applicable to bookmakers. And furthermore, we suggest that pending a complete review of the industry, we suggest a delay of the proposed withholding tax on punters' winnings, as recently suggested by the Minister of Finance in his budget speech, so as to avoid manipulation of bets and further migration to bookmakers. In conclusion, Gold Circle considers that the sport has a funding crisis, and there is no guarantee that it will survive the economic downturn without urgent intervention. A new facilitative approach to the sport is justified in the short term to avoid a further decline in the sport. Gold Circle, as mentioned, does not support the separation of the operation of racing from the totalisator. Other successful jurisdictions suggest the opposite. Gold Circle agrees that a further investigation of proposals to make the NHA a national regulator should be undertaken. In the interim, other industry participants must be obliged to contribute to the funding of the National Horse Racing Authority. It is Gold Circle's submission that at present the sport supports approximately 16,000 direct and indirect jobs, excluding many, many upstream and downstream job creation opportunities. The potential of these upstream and downstream opportunities of the sport is often vastly underestimated. For example, the sport generates approximately 40,000 thoroughbred horses which pass to the leisure industry, and the employment associated with those horses alone is in the region of 100,000 persons. Gold Circle supports the Commission's recommendation that further investigation of the sport should be conducted urgently and tenders its full support and cooperation to that process. In summary, we seek most importantly, one, full recognition that thoroughbred horse racing is a sport. Two, a levelling of the regulatory playing field to enable us to compete fairly and efficiently. Three, respect for our intellectual property, which is currently being abused. And lastly, for there to be no consideration to separate ownership of the tote from the racecourse operator. I thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much, Mr. Hawkins. I must say, quite a very interesting sort of explanation of the sport of horse racing. Thank you very much. Members, I know that there are some questions. Let's do it in the same way we did last time. Just three or four hands and restrict yourselves to a minute each, please. May I see by show of hands very quickly, Honourable Salah, Honourable Khadebe, and you may hold up your hand, Honourable Salah. I know why you're hesitating, but Honourable Salah.
Thanks, Chairperson. The key question that comes to mind from this presentation is the question of funding by government. When one looks at how the different other sport codes address this, and something came to me about racing, and something came to me about rugby, football, and how they get run without government having to come in. What is the role of private sector currently in the assistance and or funding of this particular sport stroke gambling?
Thank you, Honourable
Khadebe.
Thank you, Chairperson. I've got only one question here. If the horse racing is going to be taken as sport, they have to be recognised as sport, what is critical here is the issue of transformation of the sector. How is it transformed? Because I only heard the mentioning of one blanket person who was a groom. Went to Hong Kong during that time. How many jockeys are coming from the historically disadvantaged group? Number three, how many horse breeders are coming from that group?
how many horse owners are coming from that group, what is it doing in the industry to ensure that this sport actually is accepted or is marketed throughout the whole communities of South Africa, so that it cannot be the same as in 1970 as in 1971 as in 2011. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honourable Hadebe. Honourable Sikanda.
Thank you, Chair. A question came to mind, and I think it's why the limitation of licenses. Why that? Secondly, is what stops you, or what are the issues of limiting your rights into broadcasting or improving that field to assist your industry in order to increase your funding module? I think you would probably be happy to know that Parliament approved a IQ bill yesterday, Indigenous Knowledge Bill, that went through Parliament yesterday. They're most welcome to go and read it at some point of time. So there is some sort of protection that is being given to Indigenous knowledge and Indigenous property. So that is now on the cards, and that's legal. But it's still got a turn to do, but it's halfway there. Would in translating the industry as to a sport, obviously the linkage to gambling should also be considered, and the taxation of that. Would that increase your revenue base in order to make it more profitable in, you know, for that industry? And will it also then assist competitive sporting broadly, bringing the overseas market and the South African market, linking it both ways in order for us to be able to race there and in order for them to race here? Will that open that market more easily for the industry in order to be able to sell that industry to that market, the breeders and the trainers? Thank you.
I made one omission. I see even the whole report, it does not also indicate about the problem of horse racing, that is, of using steroids in the horses. Is it right in South Africa? How are you controlling it? Thanks.
Thank you very much, members. I have just a couple of points here. The one is just on this copyright issue, which you made a reference to, and so on the IP, if we can get some, just an expansion on that. The other point you made was the phrase, we must have greater freedom to do the same as other gambling operators with respect to, you know, all your yays and nays and whatever in that area. And then the other point is about the jobs that are created and the contribution to the economy. It's not very clear what the level of jobs are in this particular regard. I know you mentioned grooms, and then I happen to know there's jockeys as well, of course, and owners. What kind of profiling do we have there with respect to owners? I mean, I imagine there must be many grooms and cleaners, etc., you know, from the majority of the population. But if we could get a feel for that. And I'm not too sure what you mean by you want the government to help fund it, because you indicated that this is a sport, it's thoroughbreeding, and so on and so forth. Were you looking at your exports, selling of horses, or what were you looking at in this regard? Or do you just want a handout?
That would be nice, but we realize that's not practical. Thank you, Madam Chair. If try to dot those down. Let me deal with the last question before yours, in terms of drug-free racing. You will receive a presentation during the course of this of these public hearings by the National Horse Racing Authority, who, as I mentioned earlier, are our regulators. They are members of the international community at every level. We strive to obviously protect the integrity of racing through ensuring that there are no transgressions from an abuse of substances perspective. We have a lab in Johannesburg which year in and year out achieves a 100% rating in terms of the test that it does. Every horse is tested that wins a race, and random samples are taken from horses from every race, from every center, depending on the decisions of the stipendary stewards who are employed by the National Horse Racing Authority. We support all of the initiatives taken by the international bodies, and we comply with their requirements, and as such we recognized, as I said earlier, by the international community as a world-class racing country, a country that that not only stages world-class racing, but which has world-class stakeholders, jockeys, trainers, horses, etc. And on that basis, we export our racing product, as you will also hear later on, to many, many countries around the world. This they would not do if they believed racing in South Africa in any way, whether it's from a drug perspective or any other perspective, to be corrupt. Clearly, you will always have an instance where the system is bucked. This occurs in all sports, and we deal very strongly with offenders in terms of the substance rules. We are very satisfied that we're on top of the situation, that there is a minimal amount of abuse of substances in horses in South Africa, but we don't rest on our laurels. We keep ensuring that new measures are introduced to ensure that we are compliant with what the world expects of us. In terms of the funding by government, it's not obviously we have a particular problem in the Western Cape where the costs have outstripped the revenues to the extent that thoroughbred horse racing in this region loses significant amounts of money each year. Obviously, it's an interesting statistic that we paid 694 million odd rand in taxes, and the industry shows, if you take into account the two operators, a surplus of around 50 million. And we just feel, particularly in the Western Cape, there may be an argument to suggest that we need to sit around the table with government and try and find a solution to ensure that the sport of horse racing in the Western Cape in particular can be salvaged. As I said, horse racing in this country has a long and proud history. We realize we're under pressure. We don't want unfair treatment. We've spoken all the way through this presentation and in our written submissions about leveling the playing fields and giving us a fair and equitable opportunity to compete. We understand we are not owed an existence. We understand full well that we need to compete, but we want to compete in the same arena and with the same regulation as is afforded others. So we're simply suggesting by that in terms of the review, we would like to believe that we can get around with the authorities and be able to work on some solutions in this regard. We're not prescribing anything. We're hoping through this process to create the awareness that the sport of horse racing is in a funding crisis. Transformation of the sector, it is fair to say that we've probably been most successful, I'm now talking about the competitors within the industry, in the arena of jockeys and of work riders. We have very special work rider programs in place to uplift the previously disadvantaged and to transfer skills to them. And this has been very successful to the extent that race meetings in South Africa are now set aside solely for horses to be ridden on the major stage by these work riders who have been graduated through various schools to a level of extreme competence in the saddle. Just the other day, last week in fact, Thursday, we crowned our KwaZulu-Natal champion apprentice, Ntandiwe Mkhutwa, who's a young black man who's still in the academy, the South African Jockey Academy, which is based in KwaZulu-Natal and which has a satellite operation throughout the country. Musi Yeni is a black rider who has recently got his Springbok colors to compete on the international stage and will be doing so again very soon. It is in the area of jockeys that we have truthfully been most successful, and in the area of work riders and transferring skills and uplifting them, to the extent that, as I mentioned earlier, all of Mike de Kock's stable assistants in Dubai are previously disadvantaged people from South Africa. We have taken, there are stud farms around the country that are sending their employees to the United States of America to be shown the world around and to uplift their skills. So we concentrate very heavily on upliftment and of transferring of skills. In the owners segment, it would be equally fair to say that we have not been as successful in getting a huge number of black owners. We are more successful, particularly in KwaZulu-Natal, with Indian owners. They are very passionate about their racing. But I do remind you of the equation that I presented to you earlier. It's very difficult to persuade people to invest in an industry where they know they're going to lose money from the get-go. You have to have a very special passion for that. And we do have some very prominent black owners and who have won very prominent races. But it is a task that is proving quite difficult. At the end of the day, ownership of a horse is freedom of choice. You go to sell and you buy a horse. And we need to create the incentives for these chaps to buy horses. But the current equation in terms of return to owners is not in any way attractive.
Can you be a bit more concise now?
Okay. In terms of the intellectual property, which is, or the protection, or the respect of intellectual property, perhaps the most obvious example of this is the fact that that our totalisated dividend forms the basis on which bookmakers are now competing in the totalisated arena by simply taking our dividend and offering that by way of a fixed odds bet when it clearly isn't a fixed odds bet, because at the time of taking the bet, the ultimate dividend is clearly unknown. And this is what is known as the open bet. And we believe that this is between 400 and 500 million a year is being lost through the open bet to the operators. And of course, that's had a significant detrimental and negative effect on the industry. That is one of the most obvious areas where our intellectual property has been abused. Also, in terms of operations, for us to introduce a new bet type, we have to get the approval of 9 gaming boards around the country. It sometimes takes us up to two years for various reasons to open a totalisator branch. We're unable to spread our network as we would like or as easily as we'd like. We're often paying rentals for up to 2 years before we can even start operating. And these are the obstacles that we are encountering on a day-to-day basis, which are proving to be a hindrance to our growth and the ability to compete fairly in the marketplace. Have I answered all the questions?
I've been looking around at the ones that you had. There was something from yourself, Comrade Salah.
But the role of private sector, my apologies. I wasn't ducking the question.
Yeah. How would you see if we divide this into two businesses? If we divide this into two businesses, because we think from trade and industry angle, the growing of horses from baby to and the sale of them as one business, and the running of the horses as another business.
That is absolutely correct. The growing of the horses from the time that they conceived, or the let me refer to it this way: the stud farm operations are distinctly separated from the operators. I refer to the breeding industry as the cornerstone of everything that happens in South African racing. Obviously, the breeding industry is the supply chain, as I referred to earlier. Stud farms produce the horses. These horses are then taken to market in a public auction environment. It is at that point that owners take over the care of those horses and put them into training with trainers. And it's at the point where they come onto the racetrack that they obviously become involved with the operators. We obviously have the responsibility of maintaining the training centers, the racetracks, providing those sort of facilities. But the breeding operation is completely distinct from the racing operation. Where I was referring to, what we do not agree with, is the separation of the totalized data operation from the race course operation. We are vertically integrated, and as I've referred to previously, that obviously has many advantages for us, and the separation of those could well be the death knell of the industry because of the fact that different agendas would be in play. As was referred to by the Chief Executive Officer of the Hong Kong Jockey Club at a meeting in London on the 7th of October. In terms of private sector, well, clearly the only money that we get out of the private sector is in the form of sponsorship, and we obviously do have a number of very valuable and much valued sponsors. I think that the fact that we're not recognized as a sport and that our intellectual property is not always fully appreciated makes it a little bit more difficult. We have to pay for all of our airtime, and obviously television is a major catalyst for getting investment.
Thank you very much, Mr. Hawkins. This is my last year, Mr. Hawkins. Really appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, for the opportunity.
Right. And I know if we do need to be in touch, we will through the committee secretary. On that note, if we can ask the next presenter, and that is Racing of South Africa, Mr. Peter Gibson, who I'm sure now knows the first Okay. Now, Mr. Gibson, you know we want to try. If you just turn that mic off, please. We need to expedite this. I think what I'm really trying to say, I'm not sure who's... is it Ms. Tuara? Who's sitting on your right? Yeah, could you move over because so that we can allow presenters who are coming next to sit next to the other presenter. Otherwise, we're going to waste 5 minutes in between. Anyone who's not presenting needs to make space. Right. Okay, so now at this point, we're having Mr. Gibson, please. And then where's the Bingo Association advocate, Stephen Budlander? Yeah. Yeah, I see you there. I didn't see your face here, Mr. Budlander. Yeah. Look, I would really... Thank you
very much.
That's Bingo, huh?
That's right. Thank
you. Are you ready? You can go without that so long, so if you can start talking.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for the opportunity to present. My name is Peter Gibson. Company name is Horse Racing South Africa. The purpose of my submission is really to reveal the full extent of the contribution made by the sport of South African horse racing to the development of South Africa's equestrian industry, ultimately the greatest prize for South Africa. We know that horse racing is the most labour-intensive of all forms of gaming and that it contributes significantly towards government taxes. What is less well known is that the sport virtually single-handedly is driving and funding research into African horse sickness, new export protocols, and pre-export quarantine initiatives. The exception is the international trade, which is supported by the Department of Trade and Industry in partnership with Racing South Africa's marketing division, the South African Equine Trade Council, Section 21, and one of 26 export councils funded by the department to drive exports. These initiatives are only sustainable if the financial health of the sport of horse racing is secure. Racing South Africa was formed after the desire to consolidate a number of like-minded organizations. It is essentially non-profit, and profits are plowed back into industry initiatives. And in the last 5 years since inception, we put back close to 20 million rand towards these. The number of functions that we perform are the following. We have a horse racing component where we facilitate and debate matters of national importance, and I list the fact book produced on an annual basis, the economic impact study, which has recently been commissioned and completed, and Madam Chair, the copies of which will be available for distribution early next week once the final data has been produced. We also have expos to market and to produce, to educate people about horse racing, and a marketing initiative that helps us grow participation in the sport. Primarily, our functions are to fund research into African horse sickness, and we do that through the supporting the Equine Research Centre, the Faculty of Veterinary Science, honor support, and we have support initiatives to the South African Veterinary Services through the Import-Export Working Group and the African Horse Sickness Trust, both of which provide additional resource and expertise towards combating the deadly disease. We also run South Africa's pre-export quarantine station, which is based in the Western Cape as part of a legislation with the European Union. And so we have a wide-ranging number of processes which aim to try and internationalize our business. Just some background on the horse business in South Africa. At the last census in 2004, there were thought to be over 280,000 horses. You've heard Graham Hawkins mention that 40,000 of those are circulating in the sport horse industry are thoroughbred, or of a thoroughbred nature. At any given time, there are 20,000 racehorses actively involved and registered with the National Horse Racing Authority. We have a further 60,000 horses that are registered breeding stock within the sport horse sector, which means that the vast majority of horses in South Africa belong in the ownership of the informal and rural community. And with that comes employment. The relationship between man and horse is an ancient one. And our ratio, we believe, is that 2.5 jobs per horse are created. With that comes numerous economic multipliers, much of which I believe have never been really registered or recorded across the board. Products and services, skills development, wealth creation, and of course the infrastructure development in the rural community. Horses keep the countryside alive, and in a country such as South Africa with a vast, underdeveloped rural community, it provides significant support. And of all of the equestrian disciplines, horse racing drives and leads the process. The South African internationalization of our South African industry has a long and proud history. We believe that 350,000 horses were exported to supply the war effort before the 1950s. Those were taken by sea, mostly supplied to India and other countries around the world, and never a case of African horse sickness was recorded. But during a 1950s outbreak of African horse sickness in the Middle East, the world took a different view of the dangers of African horse sickness, and exports from South Africa and the rest of Africa, in fact, were suspended. And this took place for the next four decades until a concerted effort between various components of the sporting and racing, veterinary, government facilities determined that enabled a protocol to be developed, which was ratified by the European Union in 1997 and adopted by a number of other countries. And since then, 1,000 horses have been exported from South Africa's free zone. And I might add that that excludes the relationship that we have with Mauritius, where we supply probably on average 100 horses per annum, which enables their racing industry to thrive. The problem at the moment with the protocol is that we have had 4 outbreaks since inception, which has led to temporary suspension. And the last one, in fact, occurred in Mamre, which is 60 kilometres up the west coast, and led to our latest suspension. But we do know that the access to global markets will be the greatest stimulus to grow South Africa's equine industry, which leads to greater rural development, employment, foreign direct investment, and of course, ultimately, the biggest prize of all, international competition, potentially in the form of the Olympic Games. I want to dwell on the South African trade in horses, which, as you can see by the slide, shows that the global value is estimated to be in excess of $2 billion per annum. South Africa's market share is less than 1%, which we value at 250 horse exports per annum, translating to 250 million rands worth of revenue to the South African economy. Clearly, the upside is enormous. Our markets, predominantly the Middle East, Southeast Asia, and we don't include China, which is a developing industry which will certainly consume the vast number of horses in the world once they regulate their gaming industry, a similar situation that South Africa faces perhaps. We have clear constraints to achieve this. Number one is African horse sickness, and I'll detail that in a short while. We have clearly non-tariff barriers. This is a real big money spinner internationally, and we are the victims of barriers which are certainly not based on risk. And of course, we have resource issues. I've mentioned that we support the South African Veterinary Services. South Africa suffered a terrible year in the agricultural sector with foot and mouth, avian influenza, and of course, African horse sickness, all leading to suspension and the loss of enormous revenue for the country. But we have had some outstanding successes. Graham Hawkins alluded to Mike de Kock leading the charge. An international trainer of some repute, Iridescence, is one of many that have won on the international stage. This is a filly that cost 160,000 rand at auction and won a race worth 14 million Hong Kong dollars. And her broodmare value was probably close to $1 million at the end of her racing career. JJ the Jetplane, the famously named horse from South Africa, won a big race in Hong Kong last year. Having endured a 100-day export trek through 3 different countries that no other country would contemplate taking. But this shows the durability and problem-solving nature of South Africans. Everisto, Graham mentioned the groom, has elevated his financial status through his commissions on this horse's victory. He's safely back in South Africa, and we believe about to race again. And not forgetting that the majority of our horse exports are in fact not racehorses, but the sport horse sector broadly speaking. And this is an endurance filly called Mansur. She was bought by the Qataris and won some of their championship races. And in fact, the endurance market probably makes up 50% of export numbers into the Middle East. African horse sickness, as I mentioned, is our single biggest constraint. It is an endemic disease. It is a virus of which there are 7-9 serotypes. It is transmitted by the Culicoides midge. We have a 90% mortality rate of unprotected horses. I'd like to refer to the number of horses that exist in the rural community. We estimate 180,000, particularly in the eastern parts of the country. These horses are particularly vulnerable. And it obviously causes problems with the formal sector because you have virus pool, which does not protect the formal sector either. So we have a serious requirement to uplift the protection of our horses in this country. The problem is the zebra, believe it or not. It has a contrary view in terms of our tourism initiatives, but it is immune,
And where there are zebra and breeding zebra, you will always find circulating virus. The recent outbreak, I mentioned Marmaray, 60 kilometres away from our free zone, which led to the suspension of exports, suffered an outbreak, and we were surprised to find the number of horses in Marmaray, probably 450, roaming around, untethered, largely, I don't mean to be critical, but under-managed, and they lost 70 horses, which has a significant impact in terms of the economic viability of those communities which are trading in horses, riding them, using them for work. But we've gone in there, we've plugged vaccine, we've microchipped, we've positively identified, we've provided veterinary procedures, plus we've uplifted knowledge in terms of their responsibility about owning racehorses, or about owning horses, sorry, within South Africa's African horse sickness controlled area. And this outbreak was the worst in 25 years, and we estimate 3,000 horses were lost. On the positive side, there's some significant research developments in African horse sickness, largely through the Equine Research Centre. New vaccine technology is clearly the way to go to protect our horses. This comes at a significant cost. We estimate 5 million euros to bring the final product to commercialisation. We're halfway there. We've got some exciting collaboration going, but we do need government assistance to drive this process forward. From an international trade perspective, a diagnostic test has been probably our Achilles heel and been able to negotiate and improve protocols. We need to establish whether the horse for export has the virus or it does not, and a real-time PCR is on the brink of being validated and accepted by the international community, which will introduce fundamental changes in the way in which we manage our horse exports. And then, of course, epidemiology is just the general understanding of the disease. That is a picture of the Marmaray outbreak. The owner on the right looking on at his recently deceased animal. It is a dreadful disease, and we need to resolve it. Not to say that other countries around the world don't have similar problems, and I'll mention Hendra, which is an Australian virus which kills horses and humans, but they still keep on exporting. I've loved this slide ever since I got involved in this business, because really what apartheid did was isolate our sporting talent, and it was a waste of talent. And those are just a handful of people. The South African horse business has an enormous role to play internationally. I've mentioned the Olympic Games. The Games are a definite possibility from a horse perspective, just as Hong Kong provided a solution for China in 2008, so the Western Cape will provide a solution for South Africa's Games events. This is our controlled area, and the greater ability for us to protect horses and control movements into the zone, the more likely we are able to convince the international community. And I think that the South African Olympic Committee should be taking this on board at a very high level. In conclusion, internationalization will grow the South African equestrian industry exponentially. We don't really know. You've seen that we have a market share of less than 1%. That is going to grow, especially if China comes on stream. International competition will start with international horse racing. The Queen's Plate, which is a famous and historical race in Cape Town, the first Saturday of July, will be the first race because it satisfies international criteria. And it was unfortunately programmed to take place, the inaugural running, in 2012, but the outbreak has killed that. But it will come back in a short space of time, I'm pretty sure of that. I've talked about the equestrian industry and how valuable it is to South Africa. Rural development, there is untapped potential in terms of employment, skill development, wealth creation. We haven't even got to this, we haven't even scratched the surface. And the sport of horse racing, as I mentioned and I started, is the driver of all of this. It is a unique sport with a long history, but it requires a secure financial health in order to provide and play and continue to play the role. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. We really appreciate that. And if we can now move to the committee. Thank you, Mr. Gibson. If you would just turn off your mic. Thank you. We just have three questions here from the committee, please. Honourable Salah, Honourable Khadebe, Honourable Obas. Thank you very much.
Chairperson, the more presentations get made about the horse trade, the more one realizes how much this can be a big business. Because horses, for purposes of racing, that racing, as I said earlier, is business on its own. But some people, I know of those in South Africa, I don't know of others elsewhere. South Africa and Lesotho, at least that I'm sure of, eat the meat of the horse. They look at the horse as just like we would look at cattle. It's meat to them. It's a serious trait. I know you're South African, it sounds like I'm joking. But truly speaking, we're talking serious business here, in the meat industry. Exports you have alluded to, but also when we grew up, before there were so many cars, horses were transported. Horses and donkeys we were using as transport in the rural areas. Donkeys are still used now, today. I don't know how horses have disappeared from the rural areas, but they were used quite a lot. But not only for that, also for agricultural purposes, you know, to pull that agricultural unit. What is it that you think is needed? Because the markets are there, they are just dormant. What is needed to revive those markets and to get this horse trading to become a viable job creator?
Thank you very much, Honorable Sanhedrin. Thank you, Chairperson. Actually, the President is alarmed by this presentation, in particular when coming to the diseases which are inflicting the horses. And then even the cry for the support from the public sector. I think that we had institutions as government, like the Agricultural Research Council. I would have expected that if there was these endemic problems like the African horse disease, they should have done research in order to help out so that we can vaccinate when necessary, so that we can have a better animal health. So what is the relationship with such institutions? Apart from that of the Agricultural Research Council, we have others like the Honest-Supported Biological Products, which is also funded by government. You expected them to really to create vaccines for such diseases, because really I think that what is critical with this industry, what I like most is the export part. Because if you export complete share, it means that we get forex for the country. And then if you get forex for the country, it means that the economy of the country becomes in a better state. So I want, what is your relationship with those things? And then the last one, because it does not come out, is the issue of your relationship with the Society for Prevention of Cruelty, SPCA. Because I know that of certain race horses, they make millions for their owners, by the end up pulling the coal trails in the township there without the proper care. What is the end for when the horses reached its racing life? Is there any aftercare, in particular for that one, for Mr. Smiley, my colleague?
Yes, Honorable Khadebe.
Yeah, thank you, Chairperson. I heard that you're doing more of research on the side of horse racing. I didn't quite get where do you get your funding to do all of that research. You certainly are doing a lot of good work. But secondly, one of the remarks made by the Commission is that the horse racing industry is in decline.
are you doing anything towards modernization, and what it is that you propose should be done to modernize the industry so that it remains as attractive or even more attractive than it has been in the past. I know that when I grew up, it was a very popular sport, but it seems to be dying down now.
Thank you very much, Honorable Kobalsa. I just have one question. You made a comment right at the end, but Australia can export horses even though they've got these, I don't know if it was viruses or what, I don't know quite what you meant by that. It was the black market. Thanks.
Regarding the gentleman's question regarding horse meat, it is clearly a product that is sold. Abattoirs accept horses for slaughter. And there is trade internationally in horse meat. Belgium is famous for their desire for horse rump. From an export perspective, African horse sickness, again, remains one of the, it would be an animal health issue in terms of certification, but it's something that we know that zebra meat is exported, but it needs to be very much under the control of veterinary services, and vaccination, which I'll get to just now, is part of that, which will leave potentially traces of exposure to the virus which might taint the meat supply. But clearly there is, and I mean, who's to say that half the meat pies we eat aren't full of horses, beaten favourites perhaps. You know, the revival of the horse trade, and I think that you were referring to the local horse trade, is correct. You know, to me, it's a question of slowly integrating the rural communities into the more formal structures, and that's not only horse racing, that's the sport horse sector as well. And we've seen that there are a number of riders that are coming through the racing scene, there are a number of polo players coming through from the rural communities, and I think the truth is that there has to be perhaps a more formal way of elevating those programs. Clearly they'll require funding, but there's a new organization that has been formed with the funding of SASCOC called the South African Equestrian Federation, though. Am I correct? Yeah. And they have a Olympic connection. They have local horse event connections, and South African horse racing will be represented there as well. But I think, to me, it's a question of integrating with certain funding mechanisms in place. And that will lift the whole scale, but at the top of the pile is exports drawing value into South Africa, which then filters down the whole system. African horse sickness. I omitted to say that we do vaccinate, and OVP has a vaccine that has been in circulation for the last 60 years. I think some of our veterinary colleagues prescribe it as a 40-year update of a 1940 model. It clearly doesn't provide the protection. Secondly, it's live modified, which means we cannot use it from an international perspective, and it doesn't, because potentially it can create a viremic response to a horse that has been vaccinated. In other words, through that viremic stage, the Culicoides midge can feed off that animal and potentially create an outbreak. And therefore it's viewed very, very cautiously by the international community. And that's part of the reason why we're developing the new vaccine, which is an inactivated, recombinant, better protection in the long run, easier to administer. The other problem with the live, it's got to have a cold chain, which makes it impossible in the rural communities. But the other thing about relationships, veterinary services has been under pressure for a long while, resource as much as anything else. And OBP is a profit-driven organization owned by government. I'd like to see a blanket vaccination program introduced by government which assists the rural communities. We do our bit through the African Horse Sickness Trust. We maybe get 2,500 vaccines into the indigent community on an annual basis, but it's a drop in the ocean. As you heard me say, we think we've got 180,000 horses roaming around without vaccination. So the problem is huge, and it really has to be driven by veterinary services. ARC clearly can play a role, but horses have only recently emerged as big business internationally. So they've just been part of people's hobby or people's work environment, pulling carts, as you said earlier. So now with exports internationalization, that's clearly an opportunity for us to try and get them to take greater note of the horse business. I'd rather my one of the operators talk on the SPCA issues, as they really manage the horse racing business. Suffice to say is that, you know, racehorses are probably the best cared for animals. And as you heard, that we think that 40,000 ex-racehorses are circulating in the sport horse community. So there's clearly a safety net anyway. And then in terms of funding, I omitted to say that when we formed Horse Racing South Africa in 2005, our shareholders really represented the broader cross-section of the horse racing community, and that's the breeders. And in terms of a name, it's the Thoroughbred Breeders Association of South Africa, the two operators, Gold Circle and Pumalela, and the owner bodies, the Racing Association and Gold Circle owner bodies. And they, almost to virtually exclusion of anyone else, contribute to our funding programs, which allows us to put money back into research. As I said, we're not profit. All money that we generate goes back into industry-related issues, particularly export-driven. And in terms of modernizing horse racing itself, again, we're on the periphery. We're a beneficiary in some respects of what horse racing does, and I think, again, the operator is best positioned to tell you what programs they're introducing to modernize and also improve the popularity, because clearly there's decline that's been revealed. It's not only a South African issue, I think internationally there's decline in horse racing. It's a complex game. It requires lots of money, and but it remains a sport of great interest and enjoyment. And in Australia, the reference to Hendra virus, strangles, equine influenza. So South Africa is not the only country, or Africa is not the only country which has equine disease. In fact, we as a country have far fewer equine-related diseases than, for example, Europe, which is full of breeding stock diseases. Hendra itself is a virus that is transmitted by the fruit bat. It occurs mainly in New South Wales and Queensland, and through the droppings is ingested by horses, which become viremic. Treating veterinarians are exposed, and numerous vets have actually died of the disease. But, and I say it goes back to veterinary service, it goes back to political will, it goes back to our ability to trade. They are more effective, let's be honest, at overcoming those obstacles, better connected internationally. And therefore, you know, we're at the brink of a breakthrough in terms of our exports, but we need a comprehensive, government-backed view that horses, the horse business is good business. Thank you.
Just a minute there, Mr. Gibson, I would like a written, some written information in this regard as to exactly how you're saying Australia gets around it. I'm talking of, you know, the trade, because you stated specifically, well, we can't export these things if we do have certain viruses. Now, it looks like they have found a way around with their high-level connections. I mean, I wouldn't know. So could we just have something in writing as to exactly how they're getting these horses out and what rule they've managed to overcome? Thank you. In writing, please. And, you know, we've run right out. I'm going to ask Honourable Smuller to raise the question both informally to get a quick response, but to raise it here, and then you won't be answering it. You'll be answering it in writing. Thank you, Honourable Smuller.
Yes, Chairperson, I'm fine with that. The issue is about linking to yours is how our laboratories that are situated in Gauteng, how they can actually play that role into solution over to overcome that problem that we do have. And the one thing that I also picked up is when you referred to the horse that traveled for a 100-day journey, you know, is it, you know, the constraints, is it constraints within our sector which we can resolve or not, you know, limiting our red tape as government? and I'm fine with those two, and the rest were answered.
Thank you very much. And just on a little housekeeping, and that is, we've got a lot of people here, and without trying to run a military operation, can we just suggest everyone becomes cognizant that there are some folks coming in before them, you know, and you at least let them have their tea and whatever first. We need to start getting back in 10 minutes, and it's now 20 past 11. Thank you. We'd like to start no later than
25
to 12.
Yes. Have you got it here?
Yes. No,
oh, yes, and
Africa.
Yeah.
Fire one.
Okay. Don't worry about it. Don't worry about it.
Yeah.
Immediately get into what I used to think was the pensioners game. I'm now told that I have no hope of playing those stakes any longer, and become quite a market sort of gambler's game. But anyway, no, I don't know. You're going to share with us where this bingo's going. And I think you've seen the pace, or perhaps you were outside. We're trying to say 15 minutes max, 10 to 15, and then you can see we're able to engage after that. So whichever way you want to go, and I'm sorry I was calling you Mr. Jeff Butlander, but it's Advocate Stephen Butlander, followed by Mr. Zeef, Mr. Brand, Mr. Abrahams, Mr. Smith, Mr. Scott, and Mr. Dutoy. Now, obviously, I'm sure you're not all speaking. Thank you.
Madam Chair, good morning, and good morning to the committee members. Thank you very much for this opportunity. My name is Stephen Budlender. I'm a member of the Johannesburg Bar, and to put your mind at rest straight away, Madam Chair, only I will be speaking in the main presentation in order to represent the views of all of our delegation members. Could I just start by saying, Madam Chair, and you should all have copies of the presentation in front of you, I hope, members of the committee, in order to assist you to follow, that we represent the Bingo Association of South Africa, BASA, which is a voluntary association that represents the interests of the bingo industry. Galaxy and Viva are the two largest bingo licensees in South Africa, and BASA, Galaxy and Viva are grateful to this committee for the opportunity to present to it on the report of the Gambling Review Commission. Just by way of brief introduction, if I could introduce the delegates here. Seated on my right-hand side, two to my right, is Mr. Lawrence Smith, the CEO of Viva Bingo, Alan Scott, two to my left, also of Viva Bingo, Mr. Chris Dutoy on my immediate left, the CEO of Galaxy Bingo, and immediately on my right, Mr. John Z from Edward Nathan Sonnenberg's. Madam Chair, the GRC made two main findings regarding bingo. The first was that a policy on bingo should be developed, which included limits on the number of bingo licenses and the number of bingo seats per province. And second, that electronic bingo terminals, wholly electronic bingo terminals, or EBTs, as I'm going to call them, should be banned. If I could ask you to bear that in mind, because the approach we take to each of those two recommendations is quite different. In respect of the first recommendation, the recommendation that there should be limits on the number of seats of bingo licenses and bingo seats per province, BASA fully supports this recommendation of the GRC. In fact, BASA itself specifically proposed to the GRC that national norms and standards be issued dealing with the total number of bingo licenses to be rolled out in each province, the provincial allocation of licenses, and the total number of seats or gaming positions per license. BASA didn't first suggest this in response to the GRC. BASA has been engaging the National Gambling Board on this issue for a number of years. So BASA supports the notion that there should be limits on the number of bingo seats and bingo licenses per province. And we emphasize that once that loophole, and can I call it a loophole because we accept it, once that is plugged, then bingo will be as tightly regulated as any other part of the gambling industry. BASA's position on the second recommendation, however, is quite different. BASA strongly opposes the recommendation that electronic bingo terminals, or EBTs, should be banned. And I'll deal with a number of these points in detail during the presentation, but by way of summary, It is clear that bingo, including EBTs, is one of the smallest subsections of the gambling industry. Since EBTs were introduced in 2005, there's been no negative impact on casino operators. Compared to other forms of gambling, bingo and EBTs have very little connection to problem gambling. Bingo and EBTs have little or no impact on the poorest members of our society. Technological advances such as EBTs are essential if bingo licensees are to survive. And so when you consider all of those points, we submit that there no need has been demonstrated at all for EBTs to be banned. Can I now focus on a very important question, and that is, gambling regulation has a purpose, Madam Chair, members of the committee. And the question is, does the proposed ban on EBTs fit with that purpose? Let's just recap on the purpose, although I'm sure it's well known to the members of this committee better than us. But the views on the minister on the purpose of regulation were recently recapped just a couple of days ago, when he emphasized the need to balance economic benefits on the one hand with potentially negative socio-economic impacts, particularly on the poor. And he emphasized the need to avoid undesirable overstimulation targeting low-income people. The views of the GRC on the purpose of regulation are no different. It's common cause, the GRC says, that the point is to ensure that gambling does not negatively affect the most vulnerable members of our society. So we're talking here about regulation with a purpose. It's regulation to avoid negative impacts on the most vulnerable members of our society. But what are the objective facts, Madam Chair, members of the committee? The objective facts are, firstly, that bingo is one of the least prevalent forms of gambling in South Africa. That's clear from the GRC report itself. It's clear that bingo patrons fall within the wealthiest strata of society, who are at the lowest risk for problem gambling. That's also clear from the GRC report itself. It's clear that bingo patrons are the least affected by gambling-related problems, and that emerges from the National Responsible Gambling Program statistics, which we've quoted in our written submissions. And it's clear that bingo centres have strict access controls which prevent underage gambling. That's also clear from the GRC report. So when one takes those four objective facts, we say that there is no serious suggestion by the GRC, and they don't say so, that EBTs negatively impact the most vulnerable sectors of our society. You will read the report, and the report contains many things, some of which we disagree with, some of which we agree with, but there is nothing to suggest that EBTs negatively impact the most vulnerable sectors of our society. Nor is there any evidence before this committee that EBTs negatively impact the most vulnerable sectors of our society. And therefore, when one takes into account the purpose of gambling regulation, there is no rational or lawful basis to ban EBTs. That, Madam Chair, should be enough, we submit, in order to put pay to the suggestion of banning EBTs. But can we deal now with the assertions underlying the GRC report and demonstrate why they do not support the conclusion that EBTs should be banned? The GRC recommendation to ban EBTs is based on three main assertions. Firstly, a concern about the proliferation of gambling. Secondly, that EBTs are casino slot machines. And thirdly, that EBTs mean that casinos face an uneven playing field. We understand the concern about a proliferation of gambling, but that first assertion, Madam Chair, is dealt with by the BASA proposal and the GRC proposal to put a cap on the number of bingo licenses and seats per province. That would resolve that first issue. So what we're left with is the second and third assertions, that the casino slot machine issue and the suggestion that casinos face an uneven playing field due to EBTs. And we submit and we will demonstrate that those second and third assertions are simply incorrect. Let me deal first with the question of slot machines. Now, the starting point, Madam Chair, and I must emphasize that everyone accepts this, is that the game played on an EBT is bingo. Everyone accepts this. The GRC accepts it, and there's no debate about it. And there can't be any debate about it because the features of bingo on an EBT are identical to the features of bingo, paper bingo, the kind of bingo that you spoke about in the introduction, Madam Chair. More than one player is required in both paper bingo and EBT bingo. Each player has a bingo card with a set of numbers. The numbers are drawn by a random number generator. They're matched against each player's card. The outcome of the game is determined by the order in which the numbers are drawn and matched against each player's card, and there is always at least one winner. I've sped through that because, as I say, everyone accepts that EBTs involve the game of bingo. That's not the debate. The debate, rather, is about the similarities between EBTs and slot machines. But we need to emphasize the material differences between EBTs on the one hand and slot machines on the other. EBTs allow the player to play the game of bingo, as I've explained. Casino slot machines, there's no game of bingo played. EBTs, there needs to be a minimum of two players. The game doesn't work with only one. It will not run, and usually many more. Casino slot machines always play by one player. EBTs, at least one winner per game, but in casino slot machines, there's no guaranteed winner. The machine might win. In EBTs, all the terminals are linked to a central random number generator to generate the numbers. In casino slot machines, each machine operates independently. And finally, the profitability. EBTs, the average GGR per month per terminal in Gauteng is 13,000 Rand. By contrast, casino slot machines almost three times as much at 43,000 Rand. So we say that this slide demonstrates that there are material differences in the way the game operates, in the amount of money produced of the game, between EBTs on the one hand and casino slot machines on the other. And it's for that reason we submit that the GRC feels compelled to rely on what it calls the look, feel, and sound approach. We know, they say, that the bingo is played here, but they say it looks, feels, and sounds like a casino slot machine. But our submission is that that is, even if that perception were well-founded, it is entirely besides the point and impossible to deal with via legislation, which is, of course, what this committee has to do. It has to consider whether it can craft legislation to deal with the GRC report. And we say that it is simply impossible to deal with via legislation and wouldn't be possible in a series of respects. Firstly, as I've stressed, everyone accepts that the game that is played on EBTs is bingo. So the complaint is not about the game. The complaint is only about the components of EBTs that are played for entertainment purposes. I beg your pardon, the components that are purely for entertainment purposes. So as we know, there are parts of the machine that actually run the game and that operate the game and that the player uses for the game, and there are other parts which are purely for entertainment purposes. And that is the complaint. It's that the GRC says feels, looks, and sounds like a slot machine. But once that is so, Madam Chair, there's no proper basis for Parliament to prevent or constrain bingo operators in providing entertainment to people who want to play bingo. It's not Parliament's business to decide how bingo should be played or what entertainment should be provided. And Parliament doesn't say to the casinos, we only want you to play poker in this particular way and provide less entertainment to people when doing so. The entertainment is not the issue. It's the gambling activity which is the issue, and that gambling activity is bingo, as we've discussed. We make the point that it is impossible to craft a valid legislative provision that is going to distinguish between electronic bingo that looks, feels, and sounds like a slot machine and electronic bingo that does not. It's impossible to craft law that distinguishes between them. It's also impossible to test and verify whether a bingo terminal looks, feels, and sounds like a slot machine. All that can be tested and verified is what is tested and verified, whether the game of bingo is played on the terminal. And what this all means is that if there is an attempt by legislation to ban the look, feel, and sound of EBTs, the only way to do so would be a complete ban on electronic bingo. And we say it would be completely irrational and unlawful to ban electronic bingo and only allow it to be played on paper when we allow electronic poker, electronic blackjack, electronic roulette, and everything else. And in that regard, Madam Chair, can I emphasize a point that is not on the slide, but which is of fundamental importance. The latest statistics from the Gauteng Gambling Board make clear that in casinos in Gauteng, 78% of the gaming revenue is derived from electronic revenue, games played electronically. Only 22% is provided by tables. So what that demonstrates is that we're in an industry that is rapidly moving towards electronic forms of these games, the traditional games which we are aware of and which we grew up with. And so one can't say to the casino industry, have your 78% electronically, but to the bingo industry, we're limiting you to the 22% on the table, on the paper. So we say that the suggestion that there is an overlap or a similarity or an identity between bingo machines and slot machines is simply unsustainable, however you look at it. That deals with the first difficulty we have with the GRC's main reasons. The second main reason that is given is that EBTs do not create, it is the suggestion that EBTs create an uneven playing field for casinos, that they disadvantage casinos unfairly. But this too, we submit, is not well-founded. The GRC's report expressly says that the concern derives from a number of issues. Prime amongst them is the lack of corporate social investment requirements for bingo licensees. They say casinos pay massive amounts to CSI and bingo investments, bingo operators don't. Madam Chair, that's simply wrong. Bingo licenses in Mpumalanga, the Northwest, and KZN already have contained commitments relating to CSI. The GRC apparently took no account of this. And Class 10 bingo operators, whose licenses were issued a number of years ago, are equally willing to make binding CSI commitments. But more importantly, Madam Chair, Section 53(1) of the Act, very sensibly enacted by this House, made clear that provincial licensing authorities, when considering both casino and bingo licenses, are entitled to impose conditions regarding CSI. Now, once that is so, if there's a complaint about the lack of CSI requirements, it's not a problem that requires a legislative fix. It's a problem that requires the provincial licensing authority to impose adequate CSI requirements in terms of their power. It doesn't require the banning of EBTs. The concern about license fees and taxes is equally incorrect. There are different license fees and taxes in relation to each of the industries, but in some respects, bingo operators are worse off. The bingo gaming tax is 12% of GGR in Gauteng, while casinos pay only 9%. If the 12% were imposed on Emperor's Palace, Madam Chair, that would result in Emperor's Palace paying an additional $40 million in taxes per year. We're talking about a very substantial figure. So it's not fair to simply look at one issue and say the bingo licensees are better off. But even if that were an issue, even if this committee concludes that the bingo licensees are better off, again, that's a matter for the provinces to resolve by setting appropriate license fees and taxes. It's not a matter that can be dealt with by banning EBTs. We emphasize that all casinos are entitled to allow EBTs to be installed and operated. Some of them have won the right to do so, but have ultimately declined to do so, suggesting that EBTs are not as lucrative as suggested. And finally, Madam Chair, we want to know how you can seriously talk about a playing field that is skewed in favor of the bingo operators, when in Gauteng, the casino industry generates gaming revenue of $6.3 billion per year. After 6 years of EBTs, the bingo industry in Gauteng generates less than 3% of that, less than 0.2 billion per year. So to suggest that we have to treat the casino industry identically to the bingo industry to protect the casinos is, with respect, not sustainable. They're a tiny, tiny fraction of the industry. Moreover, Madam Chair, we emphasize that the fact that the casinos fear competition from bingo operators, even if that were well-founded, is not a proper basis to ban EBTs. The Constitution, we know, Madam Chair, protects competition as being in the public welfare, and the Constitutional Court has held that this is the case in the Pumalela case, that is a gambling case, which we have cited in the presentation. Perhaps most fundamentally, Madam Chair, we do not understand how the GRC can propose banning EBTs because of a worry about the casino industries and competition for the casino industry, when it adopts exactly the opposite approach in a different section of its report. In a different section of the report which we've quoted, the GRC states about betting exchanges, much of the opposition to betting exchanges appears to be derived from concerns by existing operators that their markets will be put under pressure from competition by betting exchanges. It's exactly the casino argument. And then it says, the Commission is of the view that the fact that betting exchanges would present competition to existing forms of gambling is not a good reason to oppose their introduction. And then it goes on to say that the Commission is aware of the point that betting exchanges make lower contributions to levies. Again, that's the gambling industry point. And the Commission rejects that. It says, the industry must, however, accept that innovation exists and that they will need to find new ways to ensure their sustainability. So you've got a well-thought-out, principled approach by the GRC set out there, but when it comes to bingo operators, that approach is discarded. So just to recap then, there were the three main assertions. The first is about proliferation of bingo. That is dealt with by means of what we propose about norms and standards. The second is about slot machines. We've explained why that's not well-founded. The third is about uneven playing fields. We've explained again why that is not well-founded. Can we finish off then by reminding ourselves of the common cause facts regarding the benefits of bingo? Because this is an industry that is contributing to employment and to taxes and to society in general. We've listed there the benefits of bingo, the socially interactive environment, the employment, which I'll come to in shortly, the contributions in the region of $5 million per site per year in gaming taxation and VAT, the promotion of BBBEE. I emphasize that the operators, both Viva and Galaxy, are all either level two or level three, or either all level two or level three accreditation in terms of BBBEE, and the spin-off opportunities for local businesses. Perhaps the most fundamental, Madam Chair, in our present economic climate is the question of job creation. Over 400 jobs have been created directly in Gauteng alone by the bingo industry. Of that, 70% of senior and junior management, Madam Chair, in the bingo industry are historically disadvantaged individuals. And that translates to 1,840 jobs created in Gauteng using the multiplier adopted by the NGB. Madam Chair, that is just in Gauteng. If bingo is rolled out across the country, it is estimated that an additional direct job, 2,700 jobs, will be directly created, which translates to in excess of 12,000 further jobs using the multiplier. So on the one hand, you've got substantial job creation by the bingo industry, and jobs in which historically disadvantaged individuals are strongly promoted. And against that, you've got a lack of any proper basis to ban EBTs. So to summarise, Madam Chair, the reality of bingo is that it is already subject to stringent legislation, particularly if the one little loophole that we've mentioned is dealt with, as we and the GRC both propose. It creates jobs and it makes investments. Strict access controls eliminate exposure to under 18s. The locations in affluent areas prevent exposure of bingo to the poor. There is no proven negative impact on the other gambling sectors, and even if there were a competition argument, that's not a reason to ban EBTs. There's a very low incidence of problem gambling, and bingo is offered in various formats, including the wholly electronic EBTs, paper and other forms, and of course the bingo operators pay substantial taxes in the form of gaming taxes, VAT, PAYE and corporate tax. Against that backdrop, Madam Chair, VASA reiterates support for issuing of national norms and standards dealing with the total number of bingo licenses to be rolled out in each province, the provincial allocation of licenses, and the total number of seats or gaming positions per license. That is the GRC report in essence, and to that extent we concur with the GRC. But VASA strongly opposes any attempt to ban EBTs. As we have demonstrated, such a ban would be unjustifiable, irrational, and unlawful. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. Now it's over to the committee. I'm looking at the committee. Yes, Honourable Kobasa, Honourable Smala, Honourable Kodek.
Yes, thanks, Chairperson. In one of your slides, you are asserting that the bingo is being played by, you know, well-earning patrons. But you know what the committee saw during the visit last week, did not look like people who are found in the beer in the bingo hall are well earning patrons. I'm not so sure how you measure that kind of how you come to that conclusion that it is paid by people who are well-earning. We certainly didn't see wealthy people in the bingo hall that we visited. The second concern that one would want to raise is that inside the bingo halls, at least those we saw, we found ATMs which could just as well attract problem gambling, and in fact an abuse of family money, so to speak. So that has got to be looked at. The third and final point, Chairperson, you are saying that you support BEE. I would like to understand in what form are you supporting BEE, triple BEE? Is it in the form of funding those who are starting small businesses in previously disadvantaged areas, or is it in the form of ownership of the bingo business by those who were historically disadvantaged, or both? What exactly are you saying about that?
Thank you, Chairperson.
I do concur with your first conclusion and the regulating part of it. What I wanted to understand in standing in front of the machines is to determine not just the look and the feel of it, but on the actual gaming part of the machine. Because one thing that one can control and legislate is probably the software that you use and how often that software through our regulating lab has got to be tested and has got to be reviewed, and there's certain standards that you do know that you've got to comply to. If the nature of the business is bingo and your entertainment area on the machine supersedes the actual playing of that, I'm going to give you an example. If I should go into a casino and if I play poker or the five rows that ever comes back, the majority of the screen proves to what I intend to play. In the bingo machine, which we saw as a committee, the entertainment area or that is being proposed on the screen is more relevant to what I'm seeing. I wanted to know, can it be diverted? Can it be changed so that I've got a bigger bingo screen and a smaller entertainment area in order to get that section right? I've got to come back to you. I've just got to think one question again. I'll come back to you now.
As a result of your oversight of this or what? Right. On for the deep.
Thank you, Chairperson. What I'd like to know, who is the bingo player? The profile of the bingo player as a whole. Where are they located? Provincial spread? Even provincial spread? On the, and then on one of the slides, they see that there's enough of opportunities to local businesses. How does that happen? And then because they want these EBTs not to be banned, who certifies their machines that they are on good standards, that are the same, and then where are they manufactured? Thank you.
Right. Thank you, Honourable Hadebe. Honourable Smaller, your short point.
The presenter referred to inconsistencies between other provinces. And maybe you can highlight it to one or two of those issues that have come across, that one area of your industry is being treated differently in another area of another provinces. So that we can just have that as an example. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I do have just two questions. I've numbered my pages. I was going to say earlier, wonderful, wonderful, so succinct, lovely slides, but quite useful if they are numbered. This happens to be, as I see it, page 16. Some material differences between EBTs and casino slot machines. Now, the thing is this, you mentioned that it sounded like a couple of companies were involved, Viva and Galaxy, as I understand it. Now, is this the loss unit or division? You see, because I'm just wondering, perhaps you can tell me how they make their money. Everyone's winning and so on and so forth, so you put some money in, you're assured you'll be one of the 50 winners or something. Could you just explain, whereas on the casino, as you say, you can play all day and there may not be a winner as such. So how are you making your money in the first place? The second thing is, one of the things I heard in passing was that bingo, the bingo is like the softer approach to gambling, and then the old ladies play it, and I've learned, of course, the rich people play it as well. But there was some approach to getting the disabled and even those who can't travel, let's put these things closer to home. in their little pension homes and I don't know what else. So I don't know, you know, maybe you can help me to understand. And then I see they even sell them in the shops to kids, these toys, bingo machines. You know, you roll this thing and then the little balls come out. So I just wondered if now you're bringing children on board as well. Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sorry, I just wanted to clarify one thing with Mr. Dutoy. Members of the committee, thank you very much for your questions, and I do apologize, Madam Chair, for the numbering of slides. I mentioned it to Mr. Zeef at the beginning, but I hope that next time we appear, we'll number our slides, Madam Chair. Can I begin with the question from the first honorable member, and the question was a very legitimate one with great respect, and that is, we say that it's mainly well-earning patrons, but on what basis do we reach that conclusion? But we reach that conclusion, Madam Chair, on the basis of the GRC report itself, because at page 77 of the GRC report, there is a detailed analysis of gambling participation by annual personal income. And what is set out there is that only 0.3% of persons earning less than 6,000 Rand a year play bingo. And then if you go across to the next column, between 6,000 and 12,000 a year, only 0.2% play bingo. Whereas if you compare it to the lotto or casino gambling or anything, the figures are astronomically higher, 26% in respect of the lotto, 2.4% in respect of casino gambling. So it's that point, that's where the evidence comes from, honorable member. And can I say that it's notable, in fact, that page 85 of the GRC report, there's a very helpful statement in which the GRC says the bulk of the South African poor are primarily exposed to the lottery, LPM, and informal gambling. It is here where the greatest potential to cause harm clearly lies. So the point that is made by the GRC itself is that the potential harm to the poor comes from lottery, LPMs, and informal gambling. They never suggest that there is a danger to the poor caused by bingo. They at no stage suggest that. So I think that deals with the first question. In relation to the second question about ATMs, the rules relating to ATMs in respect of bingo halls are identical to the rules relating to ATMs in respect of casinos. So there is certainly no difference between those. And again, of course, if this committee is unhappy with those rules, then as I understand it, that's a matter for provincial competence, and perhaps the provinces should be prevailed upon to deal with it. But that's not a basis to ban EBT. The third point that is made is the question of BEE. In what form does it occur? And certainly in the bingo industry, a significant portion is about BEE ownership. The Galaxy, for example, is owned by HCI, which is owned in turn by the union, Sucktroop. So we're talking about, if I can, I don't want to disparage any form of BEE, but this is real BEE, Madam Chair. This is an industry in which black people have a substantial stake, and not just black people, but workers, via a union investment holding operation. So it is real BEE that we are talking about. The second honourable member asked questions about the question of the screen, the software and the screen, and would it be possible to have a bigger bingo screen? Well, Madam Chair, anything is possible. And the fact that anything is possible is demonstrated by a point that I want to emphasize. I understand that when this committee visited a bingo venue, you saw the EBT, which has the two screens, the top screen and the bottom screen. That is called the Trimline machine, which is the first generation EBT. But I wish to tell you that the bingo industry is now embarking rapidly on using other forms of EBTs, in particular something called an AVP machine, AVP. Now, the AVP doesn't have two screens. It's got one single screen on which you see both the bingo activity, if I can call it that, you see the inner workings of the game, if I can say that loosely, and you get your entertainment. So you see it all, you've taken the two screens, and it's combined into one screen. Now, That, in fact, that AVT is what both Galaxy and Viva are now in the process of buying or renting whenever they get new machines. So it's unfortunate that perhaps that at the venue that you went to, no AVPs were there yet. But if one goes, for example, to the Colonnade or one goes to Rev, there are numerous AVPs, and those AVPs have a different form to the trim line. But there's a more fundamental point. Madam Chair, members of the committee, technology changes. This committee and Parliament, with great respect, can't ban EVTs or try and prevent EVTs on the basis of what one form of EVT happens to look like. Technology changes constantly. And so the legislation would be out of date and out of sync at the moment technology moves on. So what one's got to ask, therefore, is what is the game being played on the machine, not what the particular machine looks like in respect of entertainment. The other point you asked about, Honourable Member, was the question of inconsistencies within provinces. I think that was in reference to the CSI issue, the fact that there are already CSI requirements in the licences in Mpumalanga, Northwest and KwaZulu-Natal, but not in Gauteng. I think the reason for that is the Gauteng licences were granted much earlier in 1998, at the stage when the National Gambling Act didn't require consideration of CSI and the social economic impact. So I think there is an inconsistency there, but that's an inconsistency that the Gauteng Board should resolve, and that the bingo operators are quite willing to make those CSI commitments. There's no question about that. They've stated it, and I've been instructed to say that. That's the reason the presentation contains that commitment. The third Honourable Member asked about the profile of the bingo player. Well, I've already given some statistics about the profile of the bingo player that emerged from the GRC report. You asked about how it works provincially. Well, at this point, Honourable Member, there are only bingo terminals operating in Gauteng. There are licences that have been issued in the three other provinces which I mentioned, Northwest and Mpumalanga and KwaZulu-Natal, but none of those have been operated. So for the moment, the only form of licensed bingo happens in Gauteng. Then the question was asked by the same Honourable Member about the spin-off to local businesses. The reason there's a spin-off to local businesses is because each of the bingo venues needs catering or needs drinks or those sorts of things. That's the spin-off to local businesses which we were referring to. And finally, there was the question of certification. How does the certification process of the machine happen? Again, it's the same process that happens in respect of any other form of machine, a slot machine or any other form of machine. The same process of certification happens by the same responsible agencies. And I can get into the details if that's necessary. And the question of manufacture, I understand that the present machines are manufactured in Nevada. Then, Madam Chair, you asked two questions. And the first is, how do you make your money? Well, Madam Chair, I would not claim to have full detail about it, but the point is that, as you know from traditional bingo or paper bingo, it's not that if 10 people each put in 10 rand to play paper bingo, that doesn't mean that the person who wins the jackpot or wins the prize gets 100 rand, that you pay 10 rand for your card, but you might win some other prize. So it's not that all of the money going in immediately comes to the person who wins. It's exactly the same, as I understand it, as a casino, where the payout is regulated in Gauteng, the levels of the payout, and as I understand it, the payout, in fact, generally tends to exceed the regulated amount in the bingo terminals. But so the payout, it's not that because every player puts in 10 rand, the winner gets 100 rand. The winner will win a jackpot, just as in paper bingo. My son's nursery school has a bingo tournament for charity, and everyone puts it. Well, the point, and that exactly brings me on to the second point, Madam Chair. Bingo, Madam Chair, bingo is a game that has been around for as long as we all have, Madam Chair. The question is, are children being exposed to it? It's not about whether bingo takes place, it's about whether children are being exposed to it. So at my son's nursery school, the kids are nowhere near it. It's money raised to promote the school and build things for them, but the children are kept firmly at home. Similarly, Madam Chair, in the bingo industry here, there are incredibly tight access controls. And if you look at the report of the GRC, I don't unfortunately have the page to hand instantly, you will see, I think it's 0.6% of the concerns about underage gambling relate to bingo. In other words, the concern about underage gambling is lower in respect of children. The concern about gambling by children is far lower in respect of bingo than it is in respect of casinos. Just give me one moment.
Now we'll have to
If I could just refer you, Madam Chair, because it deals directly with your question, page 89, gambling performed by underage gamblers. That lists in order the concern about gambling by underage gamblers. 74% was dice, 20.2% was lotto, then there's a series of others. Casinos is 6.4%. Bingo, Madam Chair, is 0.6%. So your concern about underage gambling is taken incredibly seriously by Bingo. That is why the Bingo operators have extremely tight access control. You can't see into the Bingo venue unless you can get in the door, and you can't get in the door unless you comply with the requirements. And so that's why when we make the submission that underage gambling is less of a problem in respect of Bingo than anyone else, we make it seriously on the basis of the GRC's own evidence, Madam Chair.
Very much. There are certain other questions we'll want to refer to you in writing, because I am aware, and I understand the poor churches, of course, are still relying on their plates or whatever, but nevertheless, I understand, you know, they do have that basic bingo, and we are not sure how it's all regulated or whether you've frequented the churches, and I don't know these. Entertainment type places, holiday resorts for families, all crowded with kids under the age of 13 who play bingo. So I'm just interested to see if any of them were interviewed in any study you may have done.
Madam Chair,
have you gone to these primary schools and nursery schools? Have you played bingo?
Madam Chair, can I just deal with that briefly, if I may? The point is that my clients are not the people who run a bingo tournament at a holiday resort or a nursery school or anything else. My clients, Madam Chair, are licensed to run bingo in a controlled, regulated environment. And nothing that I've said deals with the question of bingo that is played with informally or in those environments. And of course, if that is happening unlawfully, then the police and the relevant authorities should be cracking down on it. But a concern about bingo being played in a holiday resort, Madam Chair, is not a reason to stop a legitimate licensed activity which is tightly regulated and which has the lowest incidence of underage gambling of any of the activities that are presented to this committee today or on the next hearing.
Right. Thank you very much, Mr. Budlander. I actually let you go on a bit because we have very few presenters on bingo, and that's why we allowed you to stretch your voice. So thank you very much, and now we're going to be dealing with a few other people as well. Thank you. We're now going to be dealing with Vet. And we're going back with Vet Fair. Right, Ken, I think you know that we want to have to focus almost on those areas you may have felt were left out. I understand yours is also the only other bingo operator here. One of the betting exchanges. You can see I'm no gambler. What is it?
Yeah.
Yeah, we can't have a dialogue here. Right, can we make a start, and let's just welcome the people from Vet Fair, Mr. McKay, legal counsel, and Mr. Tom Cuxley, public affairs officer of Vet Fair. Can you try to keep yours down? See, this is a form of gambling.
Sports betting and betting exchange, Madam Chair.
All right, fine. And we have 10 minutes and then an engagement, please.
Of course. I'll try and keep it as quick as possible. Firstly, thank you very much, Madam Chair, honourable members of the committee, for welcoming us here today and the honour of addressing this committee today. First of all, I'd like to start by welcoming the findings of the Gambling Review Commission and congratulate the members on their report, the thorough and detailed report which they've produced. In particular, from a personal perspective, the recommendation that betting exchanges be included in any new regulatory regime. With regards to what I'm going to say today, I'll start with a quick overview of Betfair itself, go on to deal with how betting exchanges work, in case some of you are not familiar with those, and then quickly run through who bets with us and some common misconceptions about the betting exchange model. First of all, with regards to Betfair,
The group was founded 11 years ago in the United Kingdom, and we were listed on the London Stock Exchange last year. Our work in the UK has been recognised on a number of occasions with prizes for innovation and international trade, and we've been recognised as Company of the Year on two occasions. We're licensed in a number of international jurisdictions, notably the UK, the USA, Italy, Australia, Malta and Gibraltar. We're seeking licences in many other countries, such as Denmark and Spain, and of course South Africa. The company has created 2,000 direct employment opportunities around the world over the past 10 years, many of them highly skilled technology jobs. And if licensed, we will make significant investment in Australia, directly creating jobs in technology, advertising, marketing, customer services, as well as indirect investment, such as into advertising, sponsorship, legal services, and all the other support services that an international company would require in a specific country. We're committed also to the policy of black economic empowerment, and this would form a key part of our business plan in the event that we're licensed in South Africa. Additionally, Betfair is strongly committed to corporate social responsibility, supporting charities and with donations of approximately 4 million rand a year since 2004, even though we're not licensed in this country. For example, we have a project, an education project for disadvantaged children, teaching them life skills. Coming on now to how betting exchange works. I appreciate the slide might look a little bit complicated, but hopefully I can guide you through it and you can get a good understanding of what it is exactly we do. First, to explain, what we are is essentially an online gambling product. There are no shops you can go into. And we're primarily a sports betting company as well. What we do is provide a market for our customers with opposing views on the outcome of sporting events. Looking at this slide, you can see it's typically what a customer will see when they log on to our site. In this case, it's a football game. You won't recognise the names of the teams, but for example, Neiman Strasbourg could easily be the Pirates and the Chiefs. I'll refer to them as Neiman Strasbourg to avoid confusing myself and possibly members of the committee. As you'll see on the left, it shows what you can bet on. Neiman to win, Strasbourg, or the draw. And this is the same as you will see with an online bookmaker, for example. The left-hand side, the centre of the screen in blue, shows backing, traditional betting, and shows, unlike a traditional bookmaker, you can see exactly what is available to bet on, and exactly how much money can be bet at what odds. With a bookmaker, you won't know how much they're prepared to accept and when the odds might change. Here you can see when they will change. It's entirely transparent. And the odds will be changing as customers place their bets. Moving on to the right-hand side, with regard to back, you back Neem to win, Strasbourg to win, or back the draw. The right-hand side shows the opportunities to lay bets. This essentially means you're back betting anything but the outcome. So, for example, if you lay Neem, you're effectively saying, I think that Neem will not win, there will be a draw, or Strasbourg will win. And the same will be true with Strasbourg. You would be laying Strasbourg, you would be saying Neem will win or there will be a draw. And finally, coming down to the draw, you're effectively saying you don't think there will be draw. It might be an exciting game when you know, both sides are, it's an end of season game and both sides are committed to win. And so you think a draw is highly unlikely. So you're saying that there will be a win, Neem or Strasbourg will win. Again, the odds and the amount available to bet is shown on the screen as entirely transparent. And you can see it change as customers place their bets. Some have suggested that lay betting isn't permitted in respectable jurisdictions around the world, and because it might encourage corruption, as effectively backing against an outcome. But this isn't the case. We have licenses in the UK, Italy, and Malta and Gibraltar currently. We're in the process of applying for a license in Denmark. We have a license in Australia as well. Denmark, Spain, Italy, Australia also licenses betting exchanges and allows laying. And in the United States, New Jersey and California have just adopted regulations to laws to allow betting exchanges to operate on horse racing. It's been suggested that you don't want to allow people to lay bets because it might undermine the integrity of the sport. But I think it comes back to and that's why you license bookmakers. But I think what we need to come back to is, why do we license bookmakers? And it's not because they lay. It's to make sure that the integrity of the event is upheld. And this is something that Beth, which I will come on to shortly, monitors very carefully. And also to ensure customer funds are protected, which is what we do, to prevent it being a source of crime, and that money laundering is not possible, and that customer funds are secure and winnings paid out. These are all the things that Betfair does, which any other bookmaker would do. Some of the other features of a betting exchange that perhaps aren't available with the bookmakers or the tote are that you can choose your own odds. If you don't see something, a price up there that you like, and you think that perhaps you might want to bet on Neem, but only if the odds increase to 4, you can request that bet, and it will be left on the site until somebody accepts the other part of the bet, and your bet is matched with the other customer or customers. Now, although we do match customers' bets, sorry, Madam Chair, this is to explain how the betting exchange works. This is by far the most time I'll spend on any slide, and the rest will move somewhat quicker. Now, although, as I've mentioned, Betfair matches punters' bets against each other, they have no idea whose bets or bets they're being matched against. Only Betfair does, and we keep a full audit trail of exactly who our customers are, what bets they've placed, their deposits, their withdrawals, and how they've funded their accounts. As you can see, there is some similarities with traditional bookmaking and the tote. Betfair doesn't take any risk on bets and has no interest in the outcome of the event, making its money by charging a commission. But like bookmaking, customers know the odds they're going to get when they place their bet at the time it is placed. And as with other online operators, Betfair decides the events on which customers can bet, sets the rules and settles bets, and holds customers' funds. Moving on to who our target market is and who bets with us. As I mentioned earlier on, it's an online-only business. You can't. There are no betting exchanges in the offline world. And it's more complicated than simply walking to a shop and handing over your money. First of all, a customer would need to have access to the internet and be familiar with our website. Secondly, they would need to register and open an account. This requires the applicant to provide an accepted form of identification, phone number, and proof of address. Where possible, these details will be verified with a third-party external source. For example, in the UK, we use the same system as banks do for checking customer identity. Once registered, a customer would need to deposit funds from a credit or debit card into their account, and under the regulations we currently operate, no withdrawals can be made until a customer's age has been verified. It's a sports betting product. It's not a get-rich-quick scheme. It's another entertainment product in the same way that bookmaking and tote betting is. Additionally, in terms of, as I mentioned, supervising the system to prevent crime, we have a closed-loop payment policy, which means a customer can only withdraw money to the payment source from which it was deposited. This means that customers can't disguise winnings can't disguise withdrawals as winnings from Betfair, as both the deposit and the winnings are paid to and from the same account. And customer behaviour is also monitored on an ongoing basis by our anti-money laundering team, so suspicious activity is reported to the relevant regulator and financial crime unit. And with regard to South Africa, we would hope if we are licensed, we would work with the National ID card system to help make sure that we have a very robust age verification and identity verification system in place. In terms of our target market, it's primarily 30 to 50 year old males, affluent males, with obviously access to the internet and payment means via banks. And it's unlikely that the exchange will be used by the poorest members of South African society. I'd like to come on now to perhaps address some of the misconceptions or criticisms of betting exchanges that some people have made. I think firstly, some have said that if betting exchanges are licensed, then bookmakers would simply cease to operate and be operate on Betfair. This is clearly not the case. For example, in the UK, which is a very mature gambling market, where betting exchanges have been available for over 10 years, traditional bookmakers continue to dominate the sports betting market. Betting exchanges have less than 25% of the online sports betting market, and the online market itself makes up only less than 20% of the total betting market. The idea that once exchanges are regulated, traditional bookmakers will cease to operate, pay tax and licensing fees because they can act as a bookmaker on Betfair for free is unfounded. A bookmaker makes its money by managing its book, but also building in a margin to its prices, the odds that it offers its customers. Given that the exchange system manages its risk perfectly, if they were trying to build in a margin to their prices and offer them on Betfair, their bets simply would not be accepted by customers because better value bets would be available from other customers. Excuse me. Moving on to another misconception about betting exchanges, that they may encourage corruption in sport or make corruption easier. Again, we feel that this is simply not the case. As I mentioned earlier, there is nothing you can do on a betting exchange that you can't do with a bookmaker, although perhaps slightly more in a more complicated fashion. For example, a tennis match. Betting on one player to win is the same as betting on the other to lose. It becomes a little bit more complicated where there are more outcomes, such as a football game where the draw is in play. But again, you can simply back one team and the draw. And also, I think it's safe to say that corruption has been around for many, many years. I believe there was even recorded instances among chariot racing in Roman times. And so betting exchanges are a recent invention, and I don't think they could be accused of causing corruption. And generally, if you go to any kind of sports betting conference which deals with integrity, most of the problems come from the unregulated market, particularly in Asia. In terms of what we do to prevent corruption, we have a dedicated integrity team which monitors markets 24 hours a day. They use software and manually monitor customer accounts and sporting events. And if suspicious bets are detected, the relevant customer's account is suspended and funds frozen whilst it is investigated. Betfair has also pioneered the system of memoranda of understanding with sports governing bodies and now has over 40 with sports and racing governing bodies around the world, including FIFA, UEFA, the International Olympic Committee, the International Cricket Commission, and various tennis federations. Where an MOU is in place, information can be passed to sports governing body for investigation either on the request of the governing body or on the initiative of our integrity team. We also provide a service called the Bet Monitor, which allows MOU partners to monitor bets on their events in real time. This service is provided free of charge, and training is also offered to making what we believe the most transparent and effective anti-corruption policy in sports betting at the moment. Betfair is also a responsible company that wants to be licensed to pay tax and to employ South Africans and work with regulators. With regard to social responsibility, Betfair is committed to sustainable gambling policy and to guarding against the negative effects of problem gambling. We offer our customers a wide variety of tools to help them in this area. We offer financial limits, both on deposits and losses, session timers. We enable self-exclusion. We're also working with a company in Oxford University on a product which will help monitor customer behaviour and alert them to any kind of problem gambling behaviour which is detected. Just coming on to conclude, Betfair is a reputable operator which is committed to be licensed in South Africa, and we've been meeting with many of your colleagues and regulators, members of the DTI, the NGB, since 2003. We believe that we've helped combat corruption rather than create it. There were fears that jockeys would be falling off horses left, right and centre when betting exchanges were first licensed, and this has proven not to be the case. In addition to integrity, we're committed to preventing money laundering and, as I've just mentioned, problem gambling. Finally, more generally, the online gambling market in South Africa has grown significantly over the recent years, and we believe that through working with reputable operators, submitting to regulation, paying tax, adopting social responsibility measures, working to prevent social and sporting corruption, and governments can, such as South Africa, the South African government, can take control of gambling and ensure that those that wish to participate in the activity are protected and the operators that offer the activity are compliant with the laws of your country. An effectively regulated online gambling market in South Africa will create new jobs, many of which will involve the development of valuable technology skills, technology jobs, many of which are highly transferable to other sectors. It will also accelerate investment in technology infrastructure in South Africa. As one such operator, Betfair is committed to adhering to all aspects of black economic empowerment, taxation, licensing, as required under South African law. Betfair would in addition like to support the Commission's plan to review the regulatory framework for governing poker, for example, and to enforce the licensing of online poker. Effective licensing would ensure safeguards to protect against money laundering, fraud, problem gambling, and to ensure fair play. In addition, substantial tax revenues could be created for the government or the relevant province. We also agree with the Commission and Professor Collins' assessment of the situation where countries have attempted to prohibit online gambling. The market exists and should be regulated effectively. For example, the example raised concerning the United States, where there continues to be a significant black market in online poker, and issues surrounding full tilt recently, we think amply demonstrate this. Realistic regulation of online gambling can safeguard against fraud, problem gambling, corruption, and create tax revenues for the country, whereas overly strict, draconian regulation could result in poor product for customers who will then simply be forced to seek out unlicensed and perhaps unsafe alternatives. And we would commend the recommendations of the commission to the committee and hope that you would follow the recommendations. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate that. From Betfair, Mr. McCabe. Members, it's over to yourselves here, please. Honourable Smala. Right. Honourable Kadebe. Right. Honourable Salah.
Thank you, Chair. I do think this is one of our concern areas in gambling in South Africa, and how we need to control that is probably for discussions forward, but it is a concern to us and to me myself. Do you control in your betting? You were referring to that you are Betfair's sports betting. And later on, you touch on poker betting and what casinos are doing. Is that part of your business? Yes or no? Just on that. Your full audit trail, the integrity of safeguarding of client information. How well do you do that, and how do you safeguard those of information from other outside information? You also confirmed that you said that there's a limitation into financial betting. How do you determine the financial betting? I know casinos have got a certain limitation per player per table when they play. What is? Have you got clear policies? How do you determine that in order to stop problem gambling? Just would like to understand that part.
Thank you very much, Honourable
Khadebe. Thank you, Chairperson. I think it's a known fact that in South Africa, online gambling is not legal. Yes, we are not doing that. It's not as legal. But I think that since they are dealing exclusively with that, when they say that it's only the sophisticated who can do this gambling, we know that internet now, you obtain it through the ordinary cell phone. You don't even need a computer. You need an ordinary cell phone. You can go into the internet and deal with that. So then, how are you going to ensure that even those people who are there are not putting fictitious people? Because I can create a personality, let's say, on the internet without covering myself. So how are you going to ensure that? And then how do you also controlling the issue of the
the problem gamblers? How do you identify them? How do you support them? Thank you.
Very much, Honorable Khadebe. Honorable Salah.
Well, Honorable Chair, I'm just a little worried that Betfair has come to Parliament to tell Parliament that it is operating illegally. That's what Betfair is saying to us. That we are currently operating unlawfully, but we want to say to you that we are committed to the highest standards of corporate governance and take our responsibility to our customers, staff, regulators and shareholders very seriously. How then? When you are already at the moment violating the laws of the country. Here's the page. Your page 6 and your last sentence there saying you'll be working with a national ID card system. What kind of card system is that? Just to get clarity on how this card system looks like. And on page 8, you say you want to be licensed to pay tax, to employ South Africans, and to work with regulators. How are you operating now? What is the status quo? What is how does it suggest to us that you are not paying tax now because you are not licensed, you are not employing South Africans currently, and you don't work with regulators? Is that what you're saying to us? A reputable operator committed to being licensed. I'm not sure whether you are applying or you are operating. Because I think my colleague has rightfully said, as far as we are concerned at this stage, online operation in gambling is not even a starting point. We do not have legal operators in that particular area. And it worries me that you are saying to us you are illegally operating in this country currently and you are asking us to give you license. Or otherwise clarify if I don't understand. But my understanding is saying we sit here as Parliament with an illegal operator in front of us saying to us, legalize me.
Thank you, Honorable Salah. Yes, I'm not sure exactly whether they indicated they were operating illegally, but the question I would like to ask, linked to the points made and the need for clarification which we seek, is exactly how are you doing this verification in the first place? Because that's one of the issues we tackled in 2009. And even engaged with the central bank here, the intelligence unit here and so on, we engaged with a number of them in our own country to say, now, if we do move in this direction, how would you verify who is operating here for this? And every one of them indicated there was no such system that could establish such a verification. So, you know, other than possibly when it came to winnings, you wouldn't be able to bring those winnings into our country because you have to state where you got the money from, you know, and that of course would then be illegal if it was an illegal operation, you see. So, and the other issue related to the verification was minors. You know, how do you know someone is not a minor operating this. Those were some of the key issues before we even went to consider that this may or may not be something we should move towards. The other point is that I thought I heard you say something about, well, we're in the UK, but you know, we're one of the smaller ones, we no threat to horse racing, no threat here, no threat the next thing. I'd say anyone I know in business wants to be a threat to their competitor. So you come with a very unique approach. We don't want competitors overtake us, you know, doesn't worry us. So it's unique, to say the very least. And so I just wanted to get a clear idea if this is the case, and if it is the case, exactly what your percentage of the gambling industry is in the UK, for example. Okay. And then you kind of indicated along the line that this would be no threat to anyone here because, well, there's always been corruption since, I suppose, biblical days and so on and so forth. Well, of course, we know, I don't want to go down that street because it happened since biblical days or whatever, that we must now tolerate it. So I'd rather work on the basis of the 21st century and what we're dealing with now. And also the idea that, I mean, who is your target market? And currently, we hear that people, that South Africans, are gambling just across our borders online. And I'm not suggesting that as Betfair has got these just across the border things, but I'm saying if they are doing that already, I'm not sure if they aren't accessing you anyway, you know, without perhaps your knowledge. Or can you state categorically there's no one in our country here operating one of your bets? Can you state that categorically and provide proof? Thank you. Kobasa?
Just one question. In one of the slides, you are saying that you are an operator who is managing their risks perfectly. What risks do you have? And secondly, how do you manage those risks? And to what extent are those risks also affecting your customers?
Thank you, Honourable Kobasa. You can see we're very interested in this because that's how we got back into gambling, as it were. And when I say gambling, I mean the gambling legislation. Thank you. Mr. McCabe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll attempt to run through all those questions from Mr. Smaller onwards. First of all, Honourable Smaller asked about whether or not we offer poker and casino. Yes, we do. These are portfolio products. Generally, online operators offer a variety of online products to keep their customers with them if they want to use these other forms of gambling. But our primary product is the Betty Sports Betting Exchange, which accounts for about 75% of our revenues. And obviously, in the event that poker or casino were not permitted under any new regime in South Africa and exchanges were, we would not offer those. Moving on to the questions regarding our audit trail and how we protect customer data and perhaps card details, we are subject to the same rules as, for example, Amazon in terms of security of your storage of details and the payment processes that we employ, and we adhere to those and are audited on a regular basis. And in terms of the customer data, it's kept on servers and processed in accordance with data protection legislation, which is enforced and applies to all businesses in the countries from which we operate. With regards to the question concerning limits, the limits are customer set, allowing a customer to put maximum limits on their own spending for each product, either by way of losses or deposits to their account. And customers can also exclude themselves, and we offer other features such as session timers in order to allow customers to control their gambling. Moving on to, I think, questions raised by the Honourable Radavi and Chairperson Bubbs regarding how we verify our customers' identity. What we do is it depends on the country in which the customer is located. In many most jurisdictions, we require copies of passports and utility bills in order to prove the identity and residence of the customer, and we also match those against the card or other payment details which they provide when registering. Where it is possible, for example, in the United Kingdom, where there are electronic databases that we can cross-match the information that we are given, we use those. That's a process which is used, for example, by banks in the UK. With regard to verifying that customers are not under the age of majority, the KYC process I've just described obviously helps to do that. If a customer registers with a we require the information that I've outlined, and we check the payment method which is used, and if it is available to those under 18, we apply some additional checks and restrictions in order to make sure that it's not a minor. If I may mention a study which was carried out by the UK Gambling Commission, where 17-year-olds were attempting to access offline bookmakers as well as online gambling services. 97% of 17-year-olds managed to place a bet in a physical offline betting shop, but only 1% managed to place a bet on an online gambling site. And so we think that in that case, we actually have a very strong proposition, and that we are able to carefully make sure that minors are excluded from gambling on our site. We also have, there are also free software packages available, such as NetNanny, which allow parents to, which can be installed on computers and allow parents to control what is what their computers are used for. And our site is designed in such a way as to...
What do you have? What system?
It's, and there's a free software, a number of...
Sorry,
Chair, madam. It's a free software package which allows parents to, it's installed on their computer, allows parents to monitor or prevent access to certain types of sites, be they gambling, pornography, such and such. What we do is our site is designed in such a way that that integrates with these packages and allows parents to control the behaviour of children who have access to their computers. And we have links to these packages on the homepage of our site. And when I mentioned the ID card system over here in South Africa, my point was that we could use copies of the system, and if there's an associated electronic database, we could verify it, cross-reference it with that, in order to help ensure that the identity of all our customers is checked and thoroughly verified. Moving on to the availability of Betfair to users based in South Africa, the site is available worldwide, and we do have a small number of South African customers at the moment. We are not fixed feet, though. We do not advertise in South Africa, target South African customers. We do not accept rand as a currency, and we also monitor legal developments in jurisdictions around the world. The reason we are here today is that internet gambling is in many cases a grey area. Obviously, there is the recent case in the Supreme Court, and we are currently reviewing that decision, and will, and once that review is complete, we will know our position of the position under South African law and act accordingly. There were further, Chairperson Phelps, you raised the issue about corruption dating back to biblical days, and sorry. You picked me up on that. what I meant to say was that some have said that betting exchanges create corruption. And my point there was simply that there has always been corruption relating to sporting events. And what I hope I managed to describe to you is that we genuinely have market-leading processes in place in order to try and prevent that and work with sports governing bodies to ensure that it is stamped out. And in that way, I think we very much have created a 21st century approach to managing corruption in sport. You also raised an issue about our target market. And as I may have mentioned earlier on, our target market is affluent, sophisticated sports bettors between the ages of 30 and 50. Obviously, they require access to the internet, in some cases by phones and tablets. But the KYC and the registration processes we have in place are the same regardless of the means of access. And as I said earlier on, these are robust and we think very effective in preventing minors from gambling and from making sure that the people that are gambling with us are the people that they say they are. And with regards to what may have sounded like that, those modest ambitions in terms of market share, again, my point was that some have said that betting exchanges drive bookmakers out of business, which we believe that the experience in the United Kingdom shows is not the case. The figures for the UK are that online sports betting is 20% of the total sports betting market, and of the online sports betting market, betting exchanges have less than 25%, with the vast majority of sports betting customers still betting with bookmakers. And obviously we want to grow our business and to, we are a business and we wish to make money, but the point is, from our perspective, they are betting exchanges are a niche product, although a substantial niche product, which should, we believe, form part of any modern online gambling law. I'm not sure.
I think we need it absolutely clear so that we don't want a misunderstanding.
No, of course. The reference to managing our risk perfectly, Honourable Sivan, was that we don't take any risk on the bets that we accept from customers. In the same way that Toast doesn't accept the risk. It pools its customers' bets and takes a commission. What we do is slightly more granular, and we match bets individually against each other, and so we don't take any risk on the outcome. So, for example, the Pirates play the Chiefs. Whatever the outcome of the match, be it a win for either side or a draw, Betfair is not exposed to the result in having to perhaps pay out more than it is accepted. With a bookmaker, they manage their book, i.e. the bets that they accept from their customers, in such a way that they may have an exposure to one of those outcomes. For example, bookmakers use a trading team of experts who determine the odds that are available, and they may think that one outcome is more likely than another, and so they may have more exposure to one outcome because they believe that is the way the sporting event will play out, and that they take the risk on some of those bets.
Yeah, I think I was referring to Honourable Salah actually at the back.
Sorry.
Although, of course, we wanted the risk one answered as well. I think Honourable Salah was really seeking a clarification. What is your status in our country, you see? You know, you're seeking to legalize. We heard so many people saying that before when they were already operating here, you see, in our. You know, they wanted some moratorium and now sort of to legalize themselves. So let's get it quite clear what your situation is here. Then there's no doubt.
Certainly. My apologies, Madam Chair. As I mentioned, I think Betfair is available and does have some customers in South Africa. We are, however, not based in South Africa and not present in this market physically. We operate from a position, operate from bases in the United Kingdom and Malta. Our views on the legality of the situation is that, as we are here today, the position with regard to online gambling is perhaps somewhat grey and unclear. However, a recent judgment in the Supreme Court has perhaps changed the situation, and we are in the process of reviewing that decision and will act accordingly.
Thank you very much. It's just that, of course, one wants to look at the law, which, as you say, you thought it was grey, but yes, it was quite clear that it was illegal. And then when you know you have South African customers, and I mean, I'm saying this with respect to any operation whatsoever, and then one continues to operate. And I think a lot of these international businesses feel that they can run riot in our country, and I would like to see that. I want to see
legitimate forms of trading in the country, you see? So I hope I'm making myself clear on that particular point. We realize now, as you say, you know, examining the law and whatever. Yes, Honorable Khadebe.
I think what was not dealt with is how do they identify problem gamblers and how do they help them put up on, because now it's online, unlike the other forms of gambling, because there's some sort of interaction. So then how do they do that? And then just like the issue of South Africa, as you said, Chef, if they know that it is illegal in South Africa, how could they have accepted people with the addresses of South Africa? Because it means that they're undermining the authority of the country. Thank you, Chef.
Thank you, Honourable Khadebe. I think that problem gambling issues are important. It would assist us.
Certainly. We provide a variety of ways that, first of all, we make significant contributions, for example, in the United Kingdom to responsibility and gambling trust on the same basis that Professor Collins was outlining earlier in relation to South Africa. And we would obviously do so in the event that we were able to obtain a license here in South Africa. And we do so in a number of other countries. For example, we've signed a recent an agreement recently with a problem gambling charity in Spain. In terms of the facilities that we offer to control gambling, we offer customer set loss and deposit limits. And so if a customer has a budget which they don't want to exceed, they can put these limits in place, and if they want to increase them, they have to wait 7 days in order to do so. And these can be set on a weekly, monthly, or other basis. Additionally, a customer who feels that they're having problems with their gambling, we allow them to self-exclude from the site, which means that their account is closed immediately, and we will not allow them to open an account or gamble with us for 6 months and perhaps longer. Any application to any desire to work with us again has to be made in writing, not email, and it's considered by our responsible gambling team who assess the request and speak to the individual in question. Also, we're working with Oxford University to develop software which will detect problem gambling behaviour, and will notify the player and help them to seek help. We also offer detailed information about the signs of problem gambling, which is available from every page of our website, through which customers can see if they feel they're exhibiting any problem gambling behaviour, and also have links to gambling charities, who we can, whose details are available on our site. And as I say, we are one of the significant funders of those in the United Kingdom. Other things that perhaps you may wish to consider in relation to problem gambling is in certain jurisdictions around Europe, a national database of self-excluded customers is being put together, where every online gambling operator will check any new customer or every time a customer accesses the site, whether they are on that exclusion register, and if they are, their account is immediately closed and they're prevented from gambling with us. And we feel that with online gambling, the audit trail and measures such as those allow better control for problem gambling behaviour than is perhaps available offline. I believe recent studies in the US have shown that although casino staff do try and look out for problem gambling behaviour, they were only successful 30% of the time in identifying it. And we believe that the person-to-person, face-to-face approach to this is perhaps less effective than people think it might be, whereas the data and the audit trail that online gambling provides allows a much better approach in terms of kind of informing customers and preventing problem gambling behaviour.
No, thank you very much. Just a minute, there. Honourable Kwabasa, who's heading up the working group in this area.
Chairperson, on slide 6, you are saying that you have a relationship with the retail banks. Are you suggesting that, notwithstanding your being not yet licensed in South Africa, you have a relationship with our banks? And in the last line of that same slide, you're talking about working with national ID system, card systems. What does that suggest with regards to our own Home Affairs Department?
Thank you very much, Honourable Kovasa.
The reference to our relationships with banks is not to banks in South Africa, but the banks that we use to process payments and in jurisdictions such as the United Kingdom and Malta. And with regard to the national ID card system, what I meant by that was that in the event that we are licensed in South Africa, we will use the best available methods for determining the identity of our customers, which we believe would include reference to the South African national ID card system.
Do you have customers in South Africa?
Yes, but...
You're wondering, I suppose, how they're getting paid, because it would be against our, FICA regulations, let alone exchange. That's South Africa, so... we appreciate your, openness with us, but at the same time, it raises a concern what we hear. So is it possible for you to respond to the comments?
As I said, we do have some customers in South Africa. I'm not familiar with the details of the exact details of the payment arrangements between BEPA and those customers, I'm afraid. But we can obviously clarify the details later on if you would require, Madam Chair.
I think we may, because that's, I keep on saying, the reason why we reopened, the first reason, was because the very first piece of legislation or anything to hit this committee was this particular one, online, whether or not we can allow this online gambling or interactive, as they called it, etc. And, we realize that, of course, the whole gambling industry needs to be put under scrutiny, having just examined that for the moment. But we weren't happy about Pig's Peak having all of this, and we had requested, and not just ourselves, other PCA portfolio committees, the Central Bank, that's the South African Reserve Bank, and our other structures of FICA, to tighten this up. We either have legislation, and we're part of international structures in this regard, and therefore we need to respect these pieces of legislation, or we all play free, And I do think, and this is why I said I appreciate you sharing this information and being open and not, but nevertheless, we want you to understand where we are coming from and our concern in the matter. So having said this, it may well be, I would hope you didn't fly out from Malta or wherever, although it's a very nice place to be on the beach. the thing is this, I know that the Honourable Kobasi would be keen to get further information in this regard, and time is against us. So I'm not sure, perhaps just during the lunch break, you could engage on a one-to-one, because he is leading this working group. And I don't know if you were in the house yesterday. I understand you were. You will see that the working group does all the work while the chair opens up a report. So when I say, there's the man, I mean it. Thank you very much. I'm going to ask once again, we saw how the tea break went. It seemed to go pretty well, all things being considered. I don't even know what lunch is there. I understand they try to squeeze money out of my account. Till I reminded them of all kinds of things like our regulations. But I believe there may be a crust of bread or something outside and a pot of tea. So if you can help yourselves and then try to get back here as 5:30 if possible. We have taken account of the air conditioning, and we're going to see what other windows could be opened. All right. What do you mean they come? Thank you very much.